I was going to wear my barefoot shoes today, but then I was listening to some of what you've been putting out. And I'm like, damn, are these actually not as good for us as we think they are? So we'll get into that. But I want to start with just your background, your credentials, your schooling a little bit, just an introduction for those who are listening, watching, who may have never come across your content. Of course, as always in the show notes, I'll have your Instagram profiles and your website and things like this. But just share a little bit about you and how you've landed with the perspective that you have now.
Yeah. Well, thank you. First off, thank you for having me. I'm completely not traditional. So my background, I didn't go to PT school. I didn't go to chiropractic school. Usually people in this world go to that type of education, a little more alternative. Mm-hmm. I didn't do that. I became a certified athletic trainer, which most people don't even know what it is. And sometimes I think it's a great thing because I can educate on it. So certified athletic trainer, you know what it is somebody who's a health professional that works on the sidelines of sports teams, goes to all the games, goes to all the practices, helps the athletes if they get injured, on the field injuries, emergency care, and then taking them to surgeries. Sometimes, you know, being there when the athlete wakes up, sometimes going in the surgery. So it's a very specific healthcare professional that works in depth with these teams, professional, college, all different levels. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do that because I just knew that that was right for me. But then when I started to actually do that in school, I realized that these athletes were treated like money and not like people. And that was a real differentiating factor in why I didn't go and do that. I actually wanted to work for USA Gymnastics because I was a gymnast growing up. That to me at that time around 2015 was a really bad time to possibly do that. There was a lot of controversy going on. And I just saw how the athletes were treated at, you know, college level. So I wanted to
describe what you mean by that a little bit.
How they were treated.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just felt like they were medically retired if they weren't performing well and they had an injury pretty quickly.
Yeah.
They weren't really heard. If they were having a problem, if they were struggling, especially certain coaches more. If they were really struggling with something like personal, they weren't heard. They were just thrown off to the PA. And I just couldn't believe that at an SEC level, high level sports, like that's how they were treated. Mm. You have these athletes, these gymnasts that are struggling with eating disorders. You can't just throw them to a nutritionist and expect it's going to get better.
Yeah.
So I just couldn't stand to watch that. And as a student, there was not much I could do at the time. So I just figured that when I finished school, I was going to figure out a way to actually help people. And that's just been a huge learning journey because almost everything I learned in school is not how I practice today. And so as an athletic trainer, I can treat people and athletes that are struggling with pain, chronic pain, anything like that. I'm not working on the sidelines of sports teams, but I am working in a clinic space, in a PT clinic where I can help people. Mm-hmm. And so when I graduated and I started to get more into, I was an Olympic weightlifter at the time, started to see how much strength and movement impacted people's health. And I was like, why didn't we take a strength and conditioning class in school? Why didn't...
Pretty wild. As an athletic trainer, you would expect that would be a prerequisite.
You would expect. Or a rehab class, why was it so minimal? We barely learned anything in rehab. And that's, I mean, we had a better rehab class and more strength and conditioning than other programs. Mm-hmm. Strength and conditioning, we would take our athletes there, but we didn't really get to learn it ourselves. They didn't take us through movements. And to me, understanding movements, understanding gait and breathing, that's healing. So I just was surprised, but also it's only 2 years of education. They're trying to fit in the bare bones. And when you leave, that's when you do really the education.
What did you study in your undergrad?
Kinesiology.
I figured it would have been kinesiology.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that from your perspective is actually incorrect as well.
I think a lot of it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think they're trying to, they give you exercise physiology and that can be useful, but it depends on where you're going to go with it. If you're going to go into research, I think kinesiology might be really beneficial. But with what I was doing, going into a health profession where I'm actually treating one-on-one, there's not much that I feel like I learned in kinesiology that has helped me. Mm-hmm. I think that there's some basics that maybe I remember from X-Phys, understanding different components of like cardiac output, stuff like that. But that doesn't really help you. There's no practical skills. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was my path. And I just found things that have worked and stuck with them. And I am a person that studies something or do everything to an extreme. I've always been like that. I loved Olympic weightlifting. I went full head into it, competed, and I just, that's how I am. Mm-hmm. So when I found something that I wanted to learn, I go full force. And that's how I am with everything. I think it's a good quality in some ways. So I did that. So I finished school, graduated, and started to work in a CrossFit gym, just helping people with what I knew from my own experience of Olympic weightlifting, plus the rehab that I knew. And it just grew and grew. And I eventually opened my own practice, kind of personal training. Mm-hmm. And then that molded itself into what I do today, which is I do postural restoration. I'm learning all these different modalities that come together to really give a full spectrum of healing for that person.
How did you get to the point of understanding posture and biomechanics from what could be called a position that's contrary to the mainstream, though, given your schooling? Like, what led you there?
Yeah, I think postural restoration is the institute that I've studied from. Mm-hmm. And we do talk a lot about posture, position, mechanics, gait, all the things that you're asking. But I didn't go there specifically for posture. I went there because I saw other humans in New York at the time doing this modality with patients and patients getting better from pain. And then also you're seeing a posture benefit. So if you're functionally doing something that helps you get out of pain, then your posture is going to change. Mm. So posture is one of the last things that changes in people. We actually see it's the last thing. People are coming in with pain, and with some work and some time, we see posture changes. Mm. And people love that. And it's not even just body posture changes. We see facial asymmetry changes. We see asymmetrical bodies change. We'll see teeth change. And we're obviously going to talk all about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's wild stuff.
I wanted to talk to someone about this for so long, especially on like the facial symmetry side of things. There's a few different accounts that I follow on Instagram who have had insane drastic changes in their physical appearance.
Yeah.
And from my understanding from the dental and orthodontic profession, they say that that's not possible in adults, that your palate has fully formed and there's no way that you can change the structure of your face at that level. But I've seen too many things that fly in the face of that at this point, where people who have like, what's it called, where you don't have an actual...
like a recessed jaw.
Yeah, recessed jaw, but then they have like the neck that isn't fully formed, like defined with their jawline, their jaw's recessed, their like nose is extremely crooked, and have completely changed their faces just by doing some postural restoration things and doing some thumb pulling and face like this. Things like this. I'm sure we can get into that. I'm sure you know some cool tricks on that, but it's wild seeing that. It's insane.
Yeah. Traditional dentists are taught that the cranial sutures close and mm-hmm. that the bones don't move, but we know that that's not true. Craniosacral therapists know it's not true. People that work in any sort of alternative field, chiropractors that study the cranium, we know it's not true. It doesn't make sense. We see changes in adults all the time. Mm-hmm. We see facial asymmetry changes all the time. So that is a myth. And also there's a lot of research to back up that cranial bones actually move. So I don't know, that's an old school myth, but that's actually what a lot of unfortunately, what we see in traditional medicine is just old school terms and sentences that people hang on to.
Yeah. I mean, that's rampant across the board, obviously, yeah, in all of medicine these days. So should we start with the feet first?
Sure.
Is that a good place to start?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So speaking of the barefoot shoe issue, maybe we start there, because like that one was so hard for me to hear as someone who just got a nice pair of leather barefoot shoes. And I have another pair of barefoot shoes that I wear basically all summer. And that being said, I have had some recurring, you know, I've managed and dealt with it quite a bit. I'm 100% disabled American veteran, which also like means nothing. I don't buy into that label. I don't identify with it. But in times where I'm having a lot of stress due to, you know, being a dad, a husband, you know, some familial issues, and then financial stress and just stress in general, right? It seems to correlate with times that I have issues in my hip and lower back. But I also have the added element that I wear barefoot shoes. Could that be leading to hip and lower back issues?
It could, but I'm not going to tell you to just stop wearing your barefoot shoes. I don't have a problem with barefoot shoes when they're used appropriately, meaning our world right now, we're in the studio, the ground is flat. We are on wood floors, concrete floors, tile floors, that's all flat. And our foot is not meant to just slap the ground. Our foot is meant to actually be mobile and mold with the ground. And, you know, our ancestors used to walk around barefoot. And that's the whole idea of the barefoot shoe marketing, is that we walk barefoot. Mm-hmm. That's what we used to do. So we should do that today. However, our modern society is not the same ground that our ancestors used to walk on. So our ancestors were walking on sand and dirt and rubble and all these different types of terrain. And today we're walking on concrete. So that's my issue with barefoot shoes. And I myself wore them for 4 years, and I did have pain, and now I don't have that pain. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a fan of barefoot shoes when you're walking on a flat surface. But if you're going hiking, you can wear your barefoot shoes because the terrain is all different, and your foot can be still mobile in them. And we typically like a shoe that has what is called a heel counter and an arch support. So there's an area in the back of the shoe that you can feel. And if it's rigid and hard, it's going to give the calcaneus, which is the heel bone, a nice reference of the ground. So our heels, I'm going to go more in depth here. Our heels have a direct connection to our teeth, our molars, and to our hamstrings, and to be able to help our pelvis stay underneath and not dump forward. A lot of people have an anterior pelvic tilt. So when we don't have heel contact in our walking cycle, our gait cycle, we're going to see problems up the chain. So even just getting somebody into a better shoe, we see mega changes in pelvis, in rib cage, in all different regions. So I'm not anti-barefoot shoes. I'm anti the use of when they're being used improperly.
Got it.
But sometimes I'm a little anti-barefoot shoes.
I mean, it makes
sense
because most people aren't walking around exclusively in uneven terrain these days, right? And it is the reason that arch support is so important, correct me if I'm wrong on this, it's because that's sending signals to your brain. I've heard you say this elsewhere, that like when you're walking on uneven terrain, your whole foot is going to feel that terrain versus just some parts of your foot when you're using barefoot shoes walking on flat surfaces.
Yeah. So you hit it nail on the head. So a lot of, in the traditional approach, they will use an orthotic to cast a foot. So they'll put a rigid arch in there, or they'll tell you, you know, you have a flat foot, we got to give you an arch. That is a very traditional approach when it comes to podiatry. I'm against that approach. I don't like rigid arches. I don't like rigid orthotics. The brain needs to sense, meaning it just needs to feel something. So like you just said, when you walk on an uneven surface, let's take sand. Sand is going to come up to meet that base of your foot, that arch of your foot, and then your arch is going to press down, and then you're going to have more ability to push off and move forward onto your opposite leg. So when we don't have a solid arch in that shoe in modern day society, we're not able to press into it for our brain to sense that arch and then push off. Also, from a nervous system standpoint, arches in the shoes, just feeling an arch, not a rigid arch, just having that arch there, actually allows the body to get more into a parasympathetic state. It's very relaxing to the body. So it's important. It's really important.
When we look at someone who has a proper gait, what does their foot actually look like as it's going against the ground?
Yeah, so
I've been struggling with this because I have my, not to make this about me, I'm just going to use this as an opportunity to talk with her about some of my issues, but I'll just touch on a few of them. My right foot, no matter how much I try, I'm left-handed, by the way, and I've heard you talk about this as well. Yeah, my right foot turns out, and I have to be conscious of trying to get it turned back in. And I have right hip issues. I have right lower back issues. My glute, if my back locks up, my glute does not fire. I can't get my glute to engage, and I have to like consciously force it to engage. There's also a lot of other biomechanics. We could talk offline.
We're going to probably do some techniques after this. But
because my left shoulder, I had surgery on it. The sport that I played, which I never ended up showing you, you asked me about it, and we got thrown off on another conversation, handball. Yeah, well, I'll show you. It's not the New York handball. But I had left shoulder surgery, and my throwing mechanics got messed up. And so instead of having a whipping motion in my arm, I was using a lot more torque turning this way and only jumping off of this right leg repetitively. Kind of like a basketball player, if they go up for a left-hand layup, they're jumping off the right leg. Similar concept. I'm a left-handed thrower jumping off of my right leg. And not all the time. Again, it correlates with stress. If I'm doing a lot of workouts, I'll have right hip, all the issues that I just explained.
Like pinching almost.
Yeah. So the original question, what does our proper gait look like?
Well, a proper gait, I want to touch on what you just talked about with your foot turning out, because that tells me something. First of all, I always tell patients that come in, don't consciously change anything when you're walking. So during gait and sleep, that's another thing I tell people, don't worry so much about your sleep position and just, you don't need to be so conscious. It actually needs to be subconscious. I need to change things subconsciously so that your brain never needs to notice a change. And eventually we get the feet to straighten out. But when you actually change it consciously, it does put extra torque on that.
Got it.
Pelvis, because that's not your natural, that's not where your femur wants to go. Your femur wants to turn out slightly for a reason, or your foot is turning out. There could be different reasons as to why it's turning out. So what we'll see, especially on the right side, so this is something that I go in depth in with postural restoration, is that we look at right versus left side, something I never learned in school. So before I even talk about this, I should actually talk about that and why, and then I'll tell you the details. We have to look at the difference between right and left side to understand what's going on. I never learned this in school, but you have a diaphragm on your right side that is bigger than the diaphragm on your left side. It is stronger and attaches lower into the lumbar spine. It pulls the body over slightly to the right. That is what we see in all humans. Even children, they still have a diaphragm like that.
And there's nothing wrong or bad about nothing that. That's just wrong. How we are naturally designed.
Okay. Inherent natural asymmetry. We also have three lobes of lung on the right side and only two on the left. Our lungs come all the way up into our chest wall. And we'll talk about breathing later with that.
I got that on the list.
Yeah. And we have a liver on the right side that's, on average, a guy like you has a 3-pound liver, right? That's a big organ that's sitting there that's pulling us more over to that right side and making us heavier on that right side. So we'll see a lot of patterns in people that come up, and it can be consistent like through a lot of people, despite... You could compare you to a ballerina, and I might see similar patterns, not the same. They're going to be overlying sort of compensations depending on what you do growing up and what you do during your developing years. But we're going to see a lot of the same patterns in most humans just due to that natural asymmetry. You mentioned you're a lefty. So interesting. I'm gonna boost your ego a little bit. But lefties are really very different. They're intelligent. And
that's right.
They,
everyone out there listen to that, all right? I'm just kidding.
You process things differently than a righty. Your brain just processes things differently. And all lefties have to be able to still use their right hand. But you said you're a lefty. You didn't say you're ambidextrous. Ambidextrosity is quite different and more difficult to manage.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Because there's usually tie-ins with primitive reflexes and tie-ins with the visual system.
Wow.
Because they never picked a side. We need to pick a side in utero. We actually pick a side as to being dominant on the right side or being dominant on the left side.
That's so interesting, because I've heard otherwise with respect to, let's say, like training, right?
Oh.
Like, and maybe it's a different context too, that like if you're an athlete who does the same repetitive motion, throwing with your left and jumping off your right, you want to balance that out by training more the other way, so your body and your fascia doesn't get adhered and out of balance.
I agree with that.
Okay.
That's different though than somebody
got it. Different context.
Like,
okay.
That if makes you sense. You have a baby, if they don't fully develop one side to be a little bit more dominant,
got it.
And then they just don't know. They could write with both hands and it doesn't feel like, you know, you're a lefty. I know I'm a righty. I can feel that feels dominant.
Yeah.
Ambidextrous, they don't feel the difference.
Got it.
But I agree. That's interesting. That is what we do in PRI. We actually develop the other pieces of the body that are missing. Because the body ends up shifting over to the right, we'll see overuse of certain specific muscles and underuse of others. And that doesn't necessarily mean the whole right side is overused, but there are certain things that are overused on one side versus the other.
And is that within the context of modern society specifically? Because I would imagine that our ancestors, even if you look at like the Kogi people, Hadza people, the Maasai tribe, they're probably not dealing with the same biomechanical issues we are, despite leaning more to the right, if you know what you're saying is true.
Yeah, I think the mechanics of what they do daily, lifting, moving, carrying, the things that they're doing, if you look at their faces, they don't have nearly as much asymmetry as us in modern day society. So I think lifestyle is a huge contributing factor. Athletics is a huge contributing factor. Take a baseball player. That's a very asymmetrical sport. Mm-hmm. So they're doing something all the time and they become more asymmetrical than maybe somebody who doesn't play baseball. Mm-hmm. So I do not as much genetics, but lifestyle plays a huge role. So back to your foot. It, right side turning out. Me too. My right foot used to always turn out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really so much anymore. But that, a lot of times, especially on the right foot, it's different on the left foot, will happen because the body's so over the right and it doesn't know how to pronate that foot into the ground. And so what it does is it just turns out. Pronating is flattening the foot, like we were mentioning before, feeling the arch, and then pushing off to move the body forward. If your brain doesn't sense an arch, it's not going to pronate. So what's it going to do? It's going to turn that foot out so you can just cheat your way there.
Wow.
So getting you in a better shoe, we'll talk about all that. I'm going to give you some recommendations after.
Okay.
And there are certain things you can do technique-wise that can actually make a significant difference pretty fast. It's not going to be immediate, but pain relief will be faster.
So you think, honestly, because I've been wearing barefoot shoes for pretty consistently now for 3.5 years, you think that could have a pretty big impact on my foot turning outward? Because I'm wearing barefoot shoes in multiple environments, but the reality is I live in modern society. I'm walking on flat surfaces more than I am uneven terrain. That's just the reality.
Yeah. And your history plays a role. Mm-hmm. So whatever your history was from age 0 to now is going to play a role. Any sort of concussions is going to make it harder for your body to go to that left side. So yeah, I do think that barefoot shoes in your case probably do have played a role. Mm-hmm. And I think that it can change pretty quickly. And most of the time when I put people in the shoes that we recommend, people can't believe it. Mm-hmm. They kind of look like dad shoes though.
Dad shoes are hip again though.
I know, I wear them. I'm not a dad.
Right, right.
So yeah. So you asked about the movement of the foot. Yep. So what's supposed to happen? So first thing in the gait cycle, we have heel strike. So mm-hmm. we have to be able to hit that calcaneus, hit that heel, and then we're going to kind of supinate a little bit, which means turn to the outside edge of your foot for anybody listening. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of more on the outside edge, and we'll see a lot of people stay there. Mm-hmm. And never actually push off. So then after slight supination, we end up pronating, hopefully, meaning mm-hmm. we're going to flatten that arch down and then we push off on that big toe. We need that big toe to push off. That big toe is the connection to the right glute. So when you said what you said, to me, it just made complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's story is like that. Sometimes people come in and it's a little bit more complicated. I have to do my tests, but just hearing this is an injury on the right side, this is an injury on the left side, I can categorize it in my head and already know a little bit about what might be going on with that person.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Just to talk to the other side of the coin, for people whose feet turn inward, for people who are pigeon-toed, what is that typically indicative of?
Less common. Sometimes there's...
So more people, their feet turn out.
Totally.
Okay.
More people's feet turn out, more people are on the outside edges of their feet and they don't ever pronate. If they're turning in, I would be really interested in what's happening at the tibia and what that rotation is going on at the tibia compared to relative to the femur.
Got it.
So I would look at that and I would probably still get them in a good shoe. So even if there's a difference in what I see, some of the solutions are actually really similar, which is great because we're all human. So a lot of the solutions need to be similar across the board. Not always, there's specifics, but for the most part.
I've heard you say that on other podcasts that I've heard you on too, is that there's not going to be a one size fits all solution across the board for all people. You have to understand an individual's history, like you said, their concussion history, their injury history, like why biomechanically they've compensated this way. And one thing that I've come to understand, I'd love to hear your take just briefly on this, is it's like the body's not making mistakes. The body's adapting as best as it possibly can given the conditions that it is under.
Yes, 100%. I don't think anything in health and medicine is ever random. Mm-hmm. I think there's always a reason our body is saying something. It's whispering at first, and then it's going to scream louder and louder if it's not getting treated appropriately. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, for people listening out there and you're going to see a provider and you're not making changes or getting better semi-quickly, especially when it comes to physical pain, then you might need to see a different provider who knows a little bit more about looking at it from a holistic perspective. Mm-hmm. I really do not think anything is random. When I hear somebody's had pain for a really long time, I have to dig into their history, and usually I find things. And when I don't find things, then I know that there's more going on from an emotional perspective.
It's usually how it goes.
Yeah, I'm starting to dive more into that. Yeah. And I'm going to take some courses in that because I'm just so fascinated. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated at the human body and the brain and how we compensate to mm-hmm. just feel okay and get through the day. But we can also feel amazing if we're treated properly.
Yeah. Amen. Well said on that. Would it be appropriate now to talk about both shoes and adjustments that you often recommend? And I'm not saying you recommend that to the listeners right now, those who are watching. Yeah, you're going to have to be like individually evaluated, I'd imagine. But just general recommendations that you typically make for people whose feet are turning outward.
Yeah. So what we just talked about with getting somebody into a shoe that has a heel counter and an arch support, that is a pretty across the board recommendation that I can give. If I actually have on my website, which I'll send you and you can post it, it's a breakdown of the shoe list. So the institute that I study from, every 6 months, they go around on a table and they do a full circle where they evaluate a bunch of new shoes on the market. Because every 6 months, these companies of running shoes, they come out with new shoes. And so just because you had a Brooks Ghost 16 doesn't mean the Brooks Ghost 17 is going to be the same. And this is a struggle for a lot of people, especially some of these chronic pain patients that found a shoe they love and they'll buy like five so that they just have shoes and they never know what the new model is. So every 6 months, once they put out the list, I redo it. I give some tidbits of information and I have an ebook for free on my website because I feel that this is the lowest hanging fruit for most people. Everyone should be able to have access to this. So I make it free for everybody. It's like a 50-page ebook. And, that's where I tell people to start.
Got it.
The shoes are categorized by low arch or high arch, but it doesn't necessarily mean that much. The biggest thing I tell people is go to the store, try them on, see what feels the best for your whole body, not just for your foot. If you notice that you get a little tighter, if your tone gets higher in one shoe and decreases in another, that's an important point to think about when you're going to spend money on a shoe.
This is such a flip from what I've come to understand up to this point, up until the last few days and listening to you more closely on the foot thing specifically, because I've, up until this point, been of the mindset that a lot of these shoes like Brooks and like sort of the thicker dad shoes are bad for our posture and bad for our health. So that's not true.
No, I know. And I have to debunk this with all of my patients. Majority of my patients that come in, unless they've been following me and learning from me for a while or have seen another provider that has helped them and they want a little bit more insight on vision or dental, it's hard because I have to debunk this all the time. But I cannot tell you how much better my own body has felt in a solid shoe that gives me those sensory guidance systems, because all we're doing with these shoes is changing the brain's ability to perceive space based mm-hmm. on your sensory system. Physical touch, feeling that ground with that foot makes a really big difference to the body's perception of space, meaning we can change the center of mass. Mm-hmm. So I know, and a lot of these zero drop shoes talk about that. And I just don't, from what I've studied and what I've read, I don't find it as necessary as finding a shoe with an arch and heel counter.
Because some of the arguments I hear is that by wearing these big bulky shoes with a lot of cushioning and things like this, and maybe cushioning is a whole separate topic, but these bigger shoes that might be hugging your arch as you're saying they're supposed to, I've heard people make arguments that that's weakening the muscles, tendons, and ligaments of your foot and you're not actually working those muscles. And if I'm hearing you correctly, your argument is that The problem is modern society, we're walking on flat surfaces all the time. So we're already not working those muscles, ligaments, and tendons as our ancestors were, who were walking on uneven surfaces like grass, rocky terrain, like sand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if we were walking that way, we would be working those muscles, but it's more important to give our brain the necessary inputs by hugging our arch appropriately so that our feet can properly go supinate and then pronate, roll over onto the big toe to push off. That's what we need more given the context of modern society. Is that correct?
100%. Nailed it. And a thing here too, people do focus very in on, oh, well, our feet are, they're going to get weak because I'm in this bulky shoe, like you just mentioned. First of all, you can train your feet. You do not have to be in a shoe all the time. There are so many tools out there for foot training. So that's one thing. Children growing up, I personally think gymnastics is wonderful because they're barefoot in a gym on all different surfaces. Of course, barefoot playing outside. I'm all about barefoot outside, frequency exchange with the ground, that Schumann resonance. I love that. I've nothing against that.
Yeah.
It's what happens with modern day society. I also think kids in a barefoot shoe is okay because they're really outside in other terrains more than we are because they're playing. And the other component is that the foot is not just, we're not just thinking muscles and bones for the foot. I'm thinking, what does it do to your neck when you're in a barefoot shoe? Is your neck locking up because your neck is staying so far over the right half of your body and it cannot get over the left half of your body? Because that's what I typically see. One of the first things I have shoes in my clinic and I test people out. One of the first things I check is their neck, because usually you put them in a good shoe, especially if they don't have a crazy history, neck will free up immediately.
Wow.
So that's the key. People don't realize your feet on the ground have a lot to do with how your eyes understand space.
Wow.
So I get that argument. Like I get trolls all the time on this. Anytime I talk about barefoot shoes.
But they're lacking context.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. They don't understand the full picture of what's going on
here. I'm sure a lot of people take you to be saying that you are against like being barefoot and being barefoot outside. And it's like, no, that's not. It's just the context of modern life for most human beings. This is the recommendation.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. The one thing that is bothersome to me as someone who has naturally wide feet is that when I'm in a barefoot shoe, my feet do feel better.
I know.
I would say if I'm, you know, really reflecting here, and I still have a lot to unpack with this paradigm because I've just come across this in the last few days with you. My hips and my back have gotten worse despite being like more holistically health oriented. So that could be a function of largely like the overwhelming majority of the time, unless I'm sitting in this studio or out on a nice date with my wife, I'm wearing those barefoot shoes all the time. I'm walking in my house barefoot all the time. So that could be a piece of it, but I still love the element of having the wider toe box. So do we know of any shoes that have both arch support and grounding ability, like a copper plate at the bottom or something like that, and a wider toe box?
So I was like trying to talk to some companies about making something like this. Maybe we can
figure it out. I'm serious.
Because for a little while, this is the biggest complaint. First of all, we don't have that frequency grounding. Second of all, we don't have that wide toe box. I also have a wider foot. I was a gymnast, so I have that. I really think that this is such a big thing that's lacking in the market and that has a heel counter and an arch support. Any shoe that I've seen that has that width is missing a heel counter. And it's really frustrating. I've tested so many shoes and it's really frustrating. I will say Brooks, you can get them in X wide. You can get them in a wider.
I have Brooks running shoes. That's what I've always had.
Yeah. And those are, they're usually on our list of solid shoes. But even the newer ones, the Brooks Go 16, I do feel like they make them pretty wide. But every 6 months, there's a new model. So I don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is the biggest thing. This is a big lacking thing in the industry. I use some types of insoles sometimes, depending on the person. If they really want to wear like a shoe like you're in right now, then we can play around with that. But it's still not the exact same. So there's a whole white space in the market for this.
Okay, we're going to make one together then. That's what we're doing.
I would love to.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, it is frustrating. But we were talking before, like, I've thought about this so much because I hear people say that the reason we're having postural issues is because of modern shoes. And that might be true to some degree with some context, for sure. Like the way they're closing off our toe box, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
That's got to be bad for our health, right? But then at the same time, I look at someone like LeBron James. Take an extreme example, obviously, is LeBron. But any other example of any professional athlete, they're wearing closed-toed shoes that are limiting their toe from really splaying out. And they're extremely explosive. A lot of them are explosive into old age if they're taking care of their bodies. So I asked you this question off camera. I want you to answer it again. Would you rather have a barefoot shoe with no heel counter or a shoe that is keeping your toes closed in with a heel counter and arch support?
I would rather a heel counter and arch support.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Completely flipping on its head everything.
Yes, because if you have that arch support in there, your foot, of course, if it's super narrow, your foot's not going to be able to splay out. And I am against the really narrow shoes. 100% agree with you. But if we have some space where the toes can splay out a little bit, if we have that pronation available, that neck is going to feel free, that person's going to be able to push off, move forward, and they'll be able to splay their toes despite the actual structure of the shoe, if there's a little bit of width there, they'll be able to splay their toes because they're pronating. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a hard question, but at the same time, heel counter and arch support wins.
Yeah, that's just what we're dealing with right now because there's mm-hmm. nothing that checks all those boxes. So you'd rather have the heel counter and arch support.
Yeah, there's no perfect mix right now. Yeah. We've found things that are just good enough.
Yeah. Okay, what do you want to move on to next? Do you want to talk, is there anything else structurally speaking, before we get up to the mechanics of breathing?
There is something I want to say. It's not just feet. Obviously, you know, I look at the whole body. When we see something happening on one side of the body, we'll see opposite on the other side of the body. So sometimes I'll see a right foot stuck in a state of supination and a left foot stuck in a state of pronation.
That's mine.
Yeah, that's very, very, very common patterning. We'll see the body weight's over on the right side. The right foot will be a little bit more lifted up. Left foot will be more planted into the ground. You'll feel your left foot on the ground more. And so the whole goal is to obviously get a little bit more homeostasis for that person. But we'll see that up the chain. So I'll see a shift in one pelvis, shift back in the other pelvis. I'll see compression in the rib cage, expansion in one other component of the rib cage. We'll see a neck that's veering to one area. So that's why, coming back to the feet, how it relates to the neck, you're not just changing something at the foot, you're changing something at the pelvis, you're changing something at the rib cage, at the neck. And for some people who have a very complicated history, you might not feel it. I have a complicated history. When I started to wear those shoes, I just felt like, okay, great, they're cushy, they feel nice. I didn't actually start to notice the change until I unlocked my cranium a little bit. Then I was like, wow, I cannot wear other shoes for a long extended period of time. Now my body's a little more resilient. I'm wearing a heel here and I'm okay. I'm fine. I can wear different types of shoes. So the goal is not to be stuck only with one type of shoe. The goal is to be in a shoe, heal your body, and then you have a little bit more versatility with what you wear.
Got it. I guess another question on feet is, I know a lot of people who are into fascial work talk about starting with your feet. And do you consider any like fascial release techniques necessary when it comes to the feet?
Yeah, I think for some people it's really powerful. I think starting at feet, I think it depends on the person, like where to really start. I don't know so much about the fascial work. I think, though, from what I've seen, people have immense changes with it. I just wonder if you are wearing barefoot shoes, you go and do all this fascial work, and then you go and walk outside on a flat surface, does your body lock back up? Because you know when you get a massage and a few days later, it kind of just feels back to normal.
Yep.
That's not the goal of a massage. You want that to stick. You want that soft tissue work to stick. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's not sticking is because the nervous system isn't really accepting it. So from what I've seen with patients, I get this comment a lot, especially from patients who are consistently seeing a massage therapist and then start working with me. They'll come in and they'll be like, well, my massage therapist said all my knots feel different. Like my back feels different. Everything feels different since we started working together. And I'm like, well, because I'm integrating your nervous system to be able to accept a new position. So now your massage therapist, the muscles have loosened up. It's not from the soft tissue. It's from the new patterning and positioning. Although I will say with fascia work, some of that does integrate for people's nervous systems.
Yeah.
It just depends on the person.
A lot of fascial work that I've come across is inextricably linked to nervous system work.
100%.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
What is a way that you help someone re-regulate their nervous system? Is it through the breath?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we use breathing.
Good segue.
Yeah. Perfect. We use breathing, respiratory techniques, and we use the sensory system. Like I just said about getting a better shoe on somebody, that could be enough to actually change someone's nervous system. But breathing is the prime resource. We have so many different positional breathing techniques, meaning you're in a specific position and you're learning to breathe in areas that are typically compressed, and you're learning to compress areas that are typically expanded. So when we understand the mechanics of the body, we understand what that person's coming in with and what kind of asymmetry they have specifically, we can tailor these exercises to what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting them really what they're lacking. So in order to get homeostasis, we got to give somebody a little bit more of what they're lacking and a little bit less of what they already have. And that's what we're doing with the breathing techniques. It's not just lay on your back and breathe.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think breathing is taught very wrong from mm-hmm. a traditional standpoint. We hear so much about belly breathing, and I'm pretty anti belly breathing.
Really?
Yeah. And that's like taught
wow.
everywhere.
Because, man, okay. I've always heard, I feel like there's going to be multiple moments like that on this. I've always heard that when you look at animals in nature who are breathing deeply, they're breathing into their full diaphragm, which means that they're breathing into their belly as well. Because our lungs, yeah, they stop near our rib cage, but if you fully inhale, it can expand down and push into your belly. Is that not?
So, well, animals are different, right? Because they have four arms on the ground usually, yeah. And we're bipedal.
Yeah.
And we're upright. So it changes it. So that's one. Also, people always compare us to babies. Babies' heads, percentage-wise, are much bigger than their bodies.
Mm.
And so we can't really compare ourselves as a full-grown adult to a six-month-old baby. It's just babies breathe amazing for their own mechanics.
Yeah.
So it's not that our bellies shouldn't move. Our bellies should move. But our lungs go all the way into the upper portion of our chest, all the way up. So that upper third portion of the lungs right here, a lot of people are missing airflow there. And a lot of people are missing airflow into our back. Our lungs extend into our back. Our rib cage is caging our lungs. So when we are assessing people and I'm looking at how somebody breathes, I'm looking at how their ribs move, because I'm getting a point to a detailed assessment of how their lungs are moving. And if they never get air into this upper third part, or never get air into the area called the posterior mediastinum, then I know that they're limited. And also that region in the back, it's kind of right where shoulder blades are, right where a bra strap would go. That region, your vagus nerve lies through there. So if we never get that stimulation, that's just a way to get vagus nerve stimulation, is to be able to breathe into that upper back. So going back to the nervous system, that's one of the ways we really can change the nervous system's resting state to be into a more parasympathetic, by getting people to breathe, which I think most people know that breathing and the nervous system go hand in hand.
Yeah.
People just think that we have to force the belly out. And I see that a lot in singers also. The way they're taught to breathe is to really use the belly. I don't think that is, I think it can be very negative. I think that's not the only way to teach breathing. The biggest thing, like I said earlier, is I don't consciously tell people to change how they're breathing throughout the day. I don't tell people to work on anything consciously. Everything is done subconsciously, meaning we're going to spend time here. We're going to work on this one technique, and then you're not going to think about it the rest of the day. And it's going to integrate with how your day moves on because of what we just worked on in those 3 minutes of working. We open new patterns, new movements in the ribcage, so the airflow will go there.
What might that look like?
I usually start people off with just teaching them how to breathe. And one of the biggest things that I do is get people to fully exhale.
Mm-hmm.
When you fully exhale, some people even have a cough reflex that gets stimulated. And so they'll literally blow all their air out and start to cough. But the goal would be, so your obliques attach into the lower part of your rib cage and onto your ASIS of your pelvis. So when you fully exhale, they bring the lower part of your rib cage and your pelvis closer together. So instead of you being in a more flared out position, they're kind of stacking you a little bit more. And so I'll usually start people laying on the ground, have them take an inhale in, just see what they're doing. A lot of times they'll have an excessive movement of their belly and no movement of their chest. And sometimes they'll see a lot of neck movement. So like where the neck will bulge out, hypertrophied muscles here. And I'll just say, okay, take a smaller inhale and now do a really long exhale until you think you have no air left and then pause. And usually at that point, they're going to feel their obliques. I'm going to say, do you feel your obliques? Like shake their head because they're out of air. They're like kind of shaking. And then I'll say, do not lose attention in those obliques and try to inhale into your chest. And they're laying on their back. So if air goes there, it's going to be kind of stopped by the ground. But getting airflow into that chest, people feel a really big difference because they're not typically breathing there. And that's not how I want people to walk around breathing. Mm-hmm. I just want to do that in that moment so that we can open up those very compressed areas. And then, of course, there's layers of asymmetry. So that's why the positional breathing is really important, the techniques we use, because if you are really compressed on the right side, then I can compress you on the left side and have you breathe into the right chest wall. I know a lot of yoga practices, they'll be like, oh, breathe here, but you're laying on your back and there's no full exhalation. You're not going to just be able to breathe into different areas. We have to compress to expand. We have to do that or else it's not going to go. It's going to go from path of least resistance, right? We're moving airflow. We're pressurizing in the thorax, and that's going to change one's complete center of mass so that they are not maybe forward in their body. They've maybe shifted back a little bit. So their body weight's now more stacked over their heels. And maybe they don't have so much of a forward head posture. So breathing can contribute to everything up and down the chain.
How might breathing relate to the anterior pelvic tilt that you see in people? Or is there any relation?
Yeah, there is. So if you're belly breathing all the time, then we're going to typically see that the body weight, the center of mass shifts forward. Mm. And so then it's just easier for you to keep belly breathing.
Got it. Okay. And how might that relate to the feet as well?
And to the pelvic tilt. So then what happens with the belly breathing, if we're only moving forward, the pelvis just dumps forward.
Got it. Okay.
And then the feet, a lot of times if we see, I mean, there's always this asymmetrical pattern going on, but we'll see a lot of more supination just depending on their history, depending on what shoes they wear, things like that.
Got it. Okay. And it seems to be this sort of feedback loop where I'd imagine the pelvic tilt then creates the conditions where it's easier to breathe more, quote unquote, into the belly. Yeah. And then when you're breathing into the belly, it just reinforces the anterior pelvic tilt.
Yeah. And because of what I mentioned, yes, chicken and egg, but also because what I mentioned before about how we're heavier on that right side, we'll actually see the left pelvis usually is much more forward than the right pelvis.
Interesting.
And there's tests for that. So it's not like I'm visibly looking at somebody and I'm going to be like, hey, that your left pelvis is more forward. Mm-hmm. I am physically taking a leg and moving in a specific way to assess what is actually going on at this pelvis. And then we use different muscles in these breathing techniques to, like, for example, if we have a left pelvis forward, the best way to explain this is for me to actually kind of break it down. So if that left pelvis is forward, I would use a left hamstring to pull that left pelvis back because the hamstring attaches into the base of the pelvis, the ischial tuberosity. So we use that muscle to pull it back. So the breathing
technique. What does that mean? Like use that muscle?
Stimulate it.
Okay, stimulate.
So meaning the breathing technique would actually encompass hamstring.
Got it.
Not really strength because it's not strength. It's a neuromuscular sensation to give the brain a different feedback.
So is it breathing while pointing your awareness towards your hamstring?
It's awareness, but it's also I will set the person up in the right position to feel what they need to feel.
Got it.
So that might mean I might put a book underneath their left foot. And so now their right foot's lower, their left foot's higher. And the position that they're in doing that breathing technique is forcing them to feel their left hamstring. That's why it's subconscious. Because if I just consciously tell them to do it, they're probably not going to feel it.
Right. Right. And you want it to stick at the subconscious level so it becomes a pattern.
Exactly.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. One other question with breathing too. I've had a couple people on, one being Dr. Vin Esposito, talking about how breathing has more to do with your ability to have to take in CO2. I'm not taking CO2, but retain CO2, let's say, rather than breathe in oxygen. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So do you know children, how it used to be like these cartoons growing up and whatnot, that they'd give the kid the paper bag to breathe into the paper bag if they were having like a lot of stress or panic? There's a reason for that, because when you're breathing in your own CO2, it actually gets you back down to a normal level of O2 CO2 ratio. But because we're so hyperinflated, meaning a lot of us are so forward, we're never fully exhaling, that ratio is off on a lot of people. People with sleep apnea, and then they go get the CPAP, that like completely messes with the CO2 and O2 ratio.
Wow.
And so I'm pretty against anti-sleep apnea devices, because there's a lot of things you can do before that. That is a last ditch effort, but that can really, really mess with circadian rhythm. It just disrupts a lot of things going on at the cell level. But another thing we'll use a lot is balloons for people to really focus on the exhale. So I think if people learn to fully exhale, their CO2 and O2 ratio gets back down to a more homeostasis level.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
This goes into like cellular components, because the breath, I mean, what else do we do as many, like 25,000 times a day? We're breathing.
Yeah. Breath is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Keeps us alive. So if we don't do it properly, we're probably not going to live as long.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of that within the construct of this paper that Dr. Gerald Pollack put out, that when we breathe, it's more about breathing in negative charge and oxygen being a good donor of electrons versus us actually oxygenating our blood. And there's a lot of context there.
That's so interesting.
It's super interesting. It's a really fascinating paper. It's peer reviewed, not that that matters, but it's, no, you're familiar with fourth phase water, right? Like
a little bit.
Okay. I'll talk to you more about this offline, but essentially that, if you look at a nitrogen molecule relative to an oxygen molecule, nitrogen molecules are smaller, but for some reason our membranes and our lungs are only taking in oxygen. How would that be if nitrogen is a smaller molecule and it's more ubiquitous in air? You would expect that we'd be taking in nitrogen too. So Dr. Pollack proposes that it's less about receiving oxygen, and it's about that oxygen relative to nitrogen is a better electron donor, negative charge donor. So it's electrifying our blood, if you will, or charging our blood rather than oxygenating our blood. So I just wonder what that looks like with CO2. And what he says to sort of reinforce that position is deep sea fish who are in environments that have low oxygen, if not near zero oxygen, are still filtering, you know, supposedly filtering oxygen from the water through their gills, but there's no oxygen at that level. So he's saying it's likely that they're somehow receiving negative ions through their gills, and it's more, respiration is more about receiving negative charge than it is receiving oxygen. Anyway,
that's fascinating.
I'm just trying to figure out how that would relate to CO2. It'd have to be like, yeah, I don't know. Hey y'all, I'm here with Melissa Kupsch from Remedy Academy of Homeopathy. We are so stoked here at The Way Forward to be partnering with Melissa and Remedy in order to spread the message of homeopathy across the world, and also to partner on the eventual development of healing centers across the United States.
People are pretty quickly coming to realize that frequency is the future of medicine. We are witnessing the great resurgence of homeopathy right now. We're really moving away from that suppressive medical model. Whether it's for eczema, asthma, hormones, fertility, anxiety, depression, trauma, whatever it is, it all starts as energy in the person's field first. If we change our field, we can completely change our life. Our two-year academy is open worldwide to anyone who wants to become a homeopath. We've got 5 lecturers, and we currently have over 500 students enrolled, which is record numbers in our field. A career in homeopathy is amazing for anyone who wants flexibility in their work and who wants to be valuable in creating this new world. We have stay-at-home parents enrolled. We have ex-medical professionals, grandparents signed up who want to learn how to heal their grandchildren and pass on that invaluable knowledge. We even have husband and wife teams. So my husband enrolled in the course with no prior knowledge of health health as a background, and he is loving it.
Kylie is also enrolled as well, so my partner is, and she's so stoked to become a homeopath and to be helping to spread this message across the world.
The thing that we hear from so many of our students is, I found my thing. Homeopathy is the key. We harness frequencies from nature and we alter the field of all creations. So if anybody wants to join us or they want to know more about it, they can visit our website.
Yeah, and all that information will be in the show notes. So if you want to learn more about Remedy Academy, also Remedy Collective, also some of the homeopathic products that they have, please just head to the show notes. All of that will be listed there. There's a recent poll that I put out on all my social media channels, and 95% of people responded that they're struggling to find their health and freedom community in person. And don't get me wrong, these platforms, these devices that you're listening to or watching this podcast on right now are great for helping to disseminate information, helping us, you know, find like-minded people to validate us, but they are not a replacement for real in-person community. At the core of our new community platform is a powerful, easy-to-use map helping you to instantly connect with like-hearted, like-minded community, including men and women, farms, schools, practitioners of all types, and other businesses near you. The platform also includes groups, social functions, messaging, and Platinum members also get access to our content library with footage from all of our in-person and virtual events like Confluence and the End of COVID, as well as breathwork sessions, Qigong sessions, member Q&As, and also member community calls. So if you'd like to support this podcast and support our mission of helping people to connect hyper-locally, in person, and also, obviously, support yourself in the process, go to the show notes or just go to thewayforward.com/join. And again, the way forward is spelled thewayfwrd.com/join. Become a member today. Help us build the way forward for mankind.
Okay, so I think it's most appropriate now to talk about airway, possibly.
Yeah.
Is that cool?
Sure.
Okay. Because I don't want to miss anything. Because the way I'm framing this conversation, we're moving up the chain, starting from the feet, talking about the meta frame, which is posture, biomechanics, and, you know, a lot of people are dealing with chronic pain these days. And we're just addressing it from a lens other than chronic fight or flight. I mean, this relates to it, though, too, because it's nervous system health. But let's say the exogenous things in reality that are leading to us believing, that's a whole separate category of things. And then food, as it relates to chronic illness, we're talking about just biomechanics with chronic illness. So airway, you think would be next, though?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Let's go into it.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I'll let you kick it off.
Okay. So airway. Airway, to me, has a lot to do with the childhood development. So with modern day society, if you take a young six-year-old and you compare them to what a person in one of, you know, a traditional tribal culture in Africa, what they look like, the jaw width and forward growth is going to be extremely different. Obviously, we know this has to do a lot with food, has to do a lot with kids today in modern society not eating crunchy, chewy foods. I mean, we have this push for veganism, and that's none of that. You're not eating steak. We also don't eat anything like raw. So in general, we have had in modern day society a much smaller structure going on in the airway, the face, etc. Some of that has gone down the chain. There's a bit of a genetic component. I think
that's what I was going to say. Like,
yeah,
I know sometimes babies that are born have already some indication. Babies naturally have a little bit more of a recessed jaw.
Yeah.
But an indication that their jaw is hyper recessed these days.
And if they're breastfeeding, they should have a recessed jaw.
Yeah.
And the thing that grows the jaw is the tongue. So this is where we can get into tongue ties and all of these components, because it's really important for the tongue to be able to get up to the roof of the mouth. So that stimulation, first of all, that's vagus nerve stimulation, the body's ability to get into parasympathetic. It's being able to properly breastfeed for an infant to have that latch. The tongue needs to be in the right position. Mm-hmm. And if the tongue is tied, meaning their frenulum, so there's a little sort of skin, it's called the frenulum, underneath the tongue. If the lips are tied, if the cheeks are tied, if that is all tight, then that tongue is not going to be pushing up and producing force forward and laterally to grow the jaw. So that is something we see. So many people have MTHFR gene, And that gene mutation has a lot to do with webbing in the mouth. And then if, you know, if mother in her genes maybe has it, gets passed down, or if she's taking folic acid, way more likely to have this deformity.
I did a whole episode on folic acid and how toxic it is.
It's so toxic.
Yeah.
It's wild.
It's one of the most like unspoken toxic things in our environment.
It was like pushed out for like years.
Yeah.
It's wild. And yeah, so we'll see this tie. Now, if it's giving a baby feeding problems, this is obviously not exactly my specialty. I'm not a myofunctional therapist. I'm all about sending children who come see me and adults who come see me to myofunctional therapists to get evaluated. I think it's a great profession. A lot of them are speech and language pathologists. So if you have a child who is not able to say certain letters, R's, etc., that's a red flag that they might have a tongue tie, especially after a certain age. And myofunctional therapists go very deep into looking at this region, the airway, the mouth. Is there proper expansion? How much airway do they actually have? Is their jaw so recessed that they can't breathe? Are they grinding their teeth at night? Are they snoring? This is for children. For infants, I think that the best time to do any sort of tongue tie release is in infancy.
Yeah.
And any older than 6 months, it's a little bit more complicated.
Got it.
So you want to do that really young. You want to make sure you're going to somebody who uses very specific type of laser. I can't remember the name exactly of that laser, but there's one laser that is really easily able to sort of evaporate the tissue versus cut it. And there's not many people that use that laser. So doing your research is extremely important here, but it goes back to development. So if you have a child that has a tongue tie that gets missed, then that child, I could talk about myself, I'm tongue tied. I'm tied everywhere. It got missed, even though there was issues with latching and breastfeeding back then. That was not something that they cared about or looked at. And then I started to suck my thumb when I was, you know, around the age of 2, 3, 4, because the brain is so smart. It's like, oh, let's just use a finger. Kids suck two fingers, kids suck a thumb, to press it there to get vagus nerve stimulation to calm the body down. So then it looks, you know, parents are like, oh, it's just this bad habit. It's not really a habit. Thumb sucking has to do a lot with the nervous system.
Wow.
And then you're having somebody who already has developmental problems because their tongue is not pushing up and growing the jaw, and they're pressing their thumb up there. So now you're having, instead of a nice wide arch, which forms the base of the nose, the palate of the mouth, we're forming this thumb position, which is going to be a really narrow arch. And the lower jaw is just coming along for the ride. So we see this a lot. I see this. I don't see so many children, but I see a lot of parents that are struggling with their children. And I will give them some advice and I will send them to providers that I feel necessary. So now there's this insane amount of children that all need expansion devices. In today's society, I think we're just more toxic in general. Our environment is more toxic, which makes it harder for these kids to properly develop. We get way less light from the sun. And that light from the sun, all that the UV rays are going to be stimulating vitamin D to be able to grow our jaw and give us solid, strong bones. So I think light and circadian rhythm is going to be really important during developmental years. These kids are inside getting blue light.
Yeah.
And that's just the majority of society. Obviously, there's people that are not doing that with their kids, but there's still a significant amount of blue light compared to UVA, UVB, near infrared that we're getting from the sun. Whereas like when me and you were probably growing up, we were outside a little bit more all the time. So I do think that it has a lot to do with development and essentially airway in adulthood. I see these people now, they come in, they were this child. They sucked their thumb. They have this narrow palate. Maybe they went to orthodontist at the age of 13 because that's the traditional approach. If you today are going to an orthodontist and they say, wait, come back when your kid is 12 and 13, to me, that's a red flag. You don't want to go see that orthodontist. You should not wait to do things. You should start at a younger age to be able to go along with the growth of the skull, because the skull stops growing by the age of 12. So you really want to make sure those teeth are coming in. You want to make sure that the palate is getting the right stimulus to grow appropriately.
So even starting prior to them losing their baby teeth.
100%.
Yeah.
And because when you start later, then people have to do more invasive expansion devices. And it's better to do something that's almost nothing for them, that just helps them stimulate a little bit of growth when they're 3, 4, 5 years old, to give them that better expansion as they get older. And then you're avoiding braces completely, which is great from multiple perspectives. The wire crosses midline. We have a lot of problems with
that.
What are
your thoughts on braces?
I think some people really do need them to get towards health.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we do myofunctional therapy and expansion at the proper timing for a child, they don't need to get braces. If development is done properly, then you can avoid braces. And
yeah,
in
this
most
is where
kids.
Dr. Wesson A. Price's work is so pivotal, because it showed that across multiple civilizations, people had perfectly formed palates. And it wasn't just diet, though. That's the one thing I think that either Dr. Wesson A. Price missed, or people misconstrue his work. It's not strictly diet. It's the totality of how they were living. And that's what you've sort of done with your work, is tie in how all of it is interconnected with our feet, with our eyesight, which we'll get into in a little bit too.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it's just diet. I think it's being outdoors. I think that's huge. I don't think people realize that the receptors in our skin and our eyes need to get sunlight.
Yeah.
Need to. It is a part of our biology, and that is going to help form our bones and keep us strong.
Mm.
I think it's huge. And it's also going to regulate our circadian rhythm, make us wake up when we should wake up and go to sleep when we should go to sleep. I think for development, it's really important. I think for infants, getting them outside will regulate them pretty quickly to, you know, when they're just born, they're all over the place. They don't know what is night, what is day. I always wonder if we just put the baby outside a little longer. I don't have kids. I don't have babies. So much easier said than done, I think, from what I'm seeing with my friends.
Like, I do Qigong every morning, and my daughter will sometimes do it with me, but trying to get my son to do it, he's just not interested. And it's, you know, it's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I can get them to go outside. Maybe they just don't like doing Qigong. I don't know. They probably think it looks goofy. I don't know. But one question I have related to orthodontics as well is on permanent retainers, because I used to have a permanent retainer and luckily it fell out. But then I've also felt my teeth started to shift back into the position that they were before braces, which is really bothering me. It's not like they're insanely crooked, but my bottom teeth were somewhat crooked. And I don't really care about the looks of it. It's more about that is indicative of my palate being smaller than it should be. And that bothers me.
Yeah. So teeth shift because the body is not holding a position of center and the tongue is feeding into that. It doesn't know where to go. There's a reason for teeth shifting. Again, like I said, nothing in health is random. There's always a reason. So when I hear teeth shifting, I know there's something going on where there's an asymmetrical influence and teeth are just trying to find center. It's your body's smart. It's just trying to tell you something. Permanent retainers, I'm not a fan. This is like, I get a lot of controversy on this. I'm not a fan for multiple reasons. First of all, they cross midline. They are made with nipple.
What's the problem with that, crossing midline?
Crossing midline is not great because we should have integration from both hemispheres of the brain. And when it crosses midline, it kind of stunts that. They are also made with like 17% nickel. A lot of people have nickel allergy.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the metal ones. There's now more Invisalign plastic ones. Who knows if there's BPA in that.
God, those might be worse though.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So obviously, we don't want anything toxic in our bodies anyway. I'm not a fan of a permanent retainer because it is holding teeth hostage. And our teeth actually need to have a little bit of flexibility throughout the day. They need to have some slight movement. We just don't want them moving into a position where their natural state is off, right? So permanent retainers are locking that up on a body that might be asymmetrical, where the teeth are trying to go back to a position of comfort. They're trying to move to tell you, hey, I'm not in a centered position right now. So what a lot of times we'll see people take out their permanent retainers, headaches will go away, body pain will go away, neck, shoulder tension will decrease. I've seen things like their eyesight changes. And they're not just doing that on its own. We're not taking out a permanent retainer and doing nothing. We're working together. We're making sure that I'm addressing their feet. I'm addressing their rib cage, their pelvis. So my biggest thing with it is don't just go get your permanent retainer out. Make sure you know where to start. Because if you don't know where to start, your teeth are going to possibly shift. A lot of people are wearing their permanent retainer so their teeth don't shift. So I'm really careful. I can say that I don't like permanent retainers while also saying you have to work with somebody if you get it taken out.
Yeah.
And some people will have no problem and some people will have a problem. I had a permanent retainer, got them taken out. I actually hated it. I remember I wasn't allowed to get mine off till after my freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. And I had it in since I was like 15 and I hated it. I don't know. At that point, I wasn't as rebellious as I am now. So I just like went with it, but I would complain about it. And it's like, why didn't I just go somewhere else and get it taken off? I think about that now. I'm like, if that was today, I would have been like, absolutely not. I'm going to go do what I want to do.
Right.
But yeah, so permanent retainers can pose problems, but also braces can pose problems. Sometimes kids come in, they're seeing me, they're like 14, 15 years old. They're in wired braces. And in order to actually get their treatment moving forward, I have to call the dentist and say, hey, let's cut this wire. Let's just take off all that tension that's happening. And they'll feel a change. They'll feel a little bit better. And then once I get their body, what we call alternating, so there's tests that I do and I can see that, then we can put the wire back on and continue the treatment. So it's not that braces are a problem. It's that timing is crucial.
Got it. Okay. What are your thoughts on getting teeth pulled?
I'm really glad you just asked that because I was just thinking, I was like, we have to talk about getting teeth pulled.
I have that.
Yeah. Well, so I am a fan of getting a tooth pulled if necessary, if it's a root canal.
It was a root canal and then it fractured and then I got it pulled.
And root canals are quite toxic. Oh, yeah. So you don't want that in your body anyway. So there's multiple reasons why they'll pull a tooth. That's one reason. Another reason is premolar extraction for braces. So they'll say, okay, 13-year-old kid, they used to do this a lot more years ago. It's hopefully fading out, but they'll say, let's just retract those premolars and squish all your teeth together and do what's called retractive orthodontia. And that is so common. People from the age of 35 to like 60, I see all the time.
Wait, so walk me through what this is.
So they will say your palate is so narrow.
Yeah.
This is typical, was typical dentistry or orthodontia the last 50 to 70 years.
Wow.
They'll say, okay, your mouth is so narrow. You don't have room for me to straighten your teeth. Let's pull out the premolars because they're unnecessary. And then we'll just put braces on you and close everything in and
that
make
is
your
insane.
Teeth. That is how orthodontia has been practiced. And there are still dentists and not dentists, but orthodontists doing this today.
Oh my goodness.
And it is insane because you're already taking somebody with a small palate and you're just making it smaller. So they're going to have consequential health impacts for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. And I see this all the time. It's very unfortunate. And some people are fine, even though that this has happened to them. Most of the time they have more problems. I almost wonder, I've always thought about this, like, does it contribute to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, things like that? First of all, the teeth are connected to meridians.
Right.
So you're taking out...
And organs.
Right. You're taking out all these teeth, and then sometimes they take out the wisdom teeth on top of it. That's on the heart meridian. So now you have a really small mouth. And we're going to see elongated faces. And usually those are the people that are mouth breathers because they probably were sucking their thumb. They probably had tongue ties. So it all goes back to development. They were sucking their thumb. They started to breathe through their mouth. They had some bad allergies. And now their palate's too small. Let's just pull their teeth. So Dr. John Mew, for people interested, have you heard of stuff? He did twin studies, which was like really controversial back then. Mm-hmm. And he had twins, identical twins, and he did retractive ortho, like what we're talking about, on one twin and expansion on the other twin. And you could see the facial changes. It's insane.
This is the guy who came up with mewing, right?
Yeah. So his father is the, it's
his father's John Mew.
John Mew, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So this
and
is the
son.
And then
the son is Mike Mew.
Got it. Okay.
But yeah, Mike Mew came up with mewing. But yeah, and the father like experimented on all the kids. There's a documentary. It's called Open Wide. It's on Netflix, and it's a great documentary. Just talking about Dr. John Mew's life. He unfortunately recently passed away, like 2 months ago. But his work is brilliant.
Yeah,
and even with mewing. So if people don't,
can you
know,
explain what mewing is,
yeah,
real quick?
Yeah, mewing is forcefully pressing the tongue up to the roof of the mouth in adulthood or children also, to help grow the palate. I think it's okay to do for sure in children. Children are much more less asymmetrical than we are. As adults, I think mewing can be okay and you can get results from it. I'm not going to say you can't get results. I see the results. They're pretty amazing. It's going to be difficult if you have a tongue tie because you're probably not going to be able to get the tongue up there. It's not all of myofunctional therapy. There's a lot of different exercises that a myofunctional therapist, someone who specializes in this, can do to also get amazing results. And what if your tongue on one side is different than the other side? What if your jaw on one side is different than the other side? Mm-hmm. Now you're strengthening something asymmetrically. There's all these things out there. I know even Joe Rogan talked about jaws or size.
Yeah.
And they recently sent me some, so I do want to try it. But I'm a little nervous because I know my jaw is quite asymmetrical. Doesn't visibly look asymmetrical, but I feel it. Mm-hmm. If I do that, am I strengthening one side of my cranium more than the other?
Got it.
So just things to think about with these products that are out on the market.
Do you recommend any other individual manual things that you can do? Because I know for one, I follow this guy on Instagram. And I've reached out to him so many times trying to get him on my podcast. He said yes, and then he stopped responding, so we never scheduled time. Oscar Patel, have you come across him? He's a younger kid. Curly brown hair. He went from having like a recessed jaw, face completely asymmetrical, posture was horrible, to looking like a freaking male model with like perfect jawline and everything. And he has multiple things that he does with taping. Like taping your face a certain way at night and not taping your mouth, taping your face a certain way, but then also thumb pulling. Are you familiar with thumb pulling?
I know a little bit about it.
Okay.
They just kind of go in and press. I think any sort of soft tissue can be beneficial. Mm-hmm. I would be interested in a myofunctional therapist's perspective on that specifically, mm-hmm. because an SOT chiropractor's also, they'll do a lot of intraoral work. I think intraoral work can be really powerful. But again, what position is the rest of the system in?
Have you seen the chiropractors? It's a very small niche of chiropractors who do this, but they do facial chiropractic where they take a balloon.
Nasal ballooning.
Dude, have you seen it done?
I have seen it done. My best friend actually did it.
Yeah.
Because she was like, I need to do it. She did 5 days in a row.
Oh my God.
Because it's what they told her.
How did she feel afterwards though?
She loved it.
Okay. Because... when I saw it in person, I was in Serbia recently. This is like 2.5 weeks ago. I was in Serbia at this event. My friend Mike Wilkerson, who is himself a chiropractor, was laying on the table, and a bunch of people at the event were talking about how there was this type of ballooning chiropractor there. They're like, you should go get it done. And I walk up and see Mike Wilkerson on the table. And again, he's a chiropractor, and he's laying there, and he has this look on his face where he looks like deathly afraid.
Yeah.
And he had already had some of the ballooning done, but he was about to have a little bit more done. I look at him, I'm like, dude, how's it going? He's like, oh, man, I'm just wondering if anyone's ever died doing this. Was his response. I was like, holy shit. And then right afterwards, he was gushing blood. He had a headache the rest of the day.
Oh, gosh.
With that being said, the next day he was like, yeah, I feel pretty good. I don't know how he's feeling now. I haven't talked to him about it since.
It's invasive. I think it depends on who does it, because also one of our shared friends has done it and she also loved it. I think it depends on the person's cranial position in the starting place.
Got it.
And I think that when I hear of like bleeding or anything like that, then I know that that sphenoid wasn't ready for it. Like that, I think it's too invasive of a treatment.
Yeah.
I do think some people, it can really help them. But again, like, do we have a cranium that's completely twisted and now we're just forcefully making a change? So I have referred some people to do it, but it goes back down to the timing. Are they ready for it? Can their body accept that sort of a treatment? Because it's pretty intense. But again, I've also talked to, I know a chiropractor who does it, and he does it very gently. And I think that that is important. Like, it shouldn't be so forceful.
Yeah, it looked really aggressive. And he was like, dude, I could feel all the bones inside my face crunching and shifting all at the same time.
So, but then it's like in 5 days from now, when he walks outside and a horn honks, does his nervous system pull the bones right back into where they were? Right. And what I think is, yes, I think the nervous system and the brain are smarter than your manipulation.
Yeah.
That's what I believe. I mean,
that brings up another question just regarding chiropractic, myofascial release, Rolfing, and things like this. Are you fans of those, or what do you think about them?
I think people get relief. So I can't be against things that people are getting powerful benefits from. I've seen people do myofascial release and get amazing releases. So I'm not going to say that doesn't work. I just think that for some people, they'll try everything and none of that will work. Mm-hmm. And those are typically the people that'll come see me for exactly what I do, because they know that they'll do 50 sessions of myofascial release and it doesn't do anything for them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those people that I'm talking about, those really, they're stuck, they have more going on cranially. And there's more to their story. Mm-hmm. If somebody just feels pretty good, they go get, you know, they don't have a crazy history. Yeah. You know, a John Barnes myofascial release might work great for them. Mm-hmm. And so it's not to hate on any of them, because I do think that those modalities work, but I think that we have to always be treating brain and nervous system. And when you're just doing like some sort of soft tissue massage, it can get very deep. It depends on the provider, depends on all of those levels.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Do you feel complete on the airway thing and dental thing? Do we miss anything? Okay.
I feel like I. Well, I didn't. Okay. You know why? Because you mentioned just getting a tooth pulled.
Yeah.
Right? So I talked about premolar extraction.
Yeah.
Just getting a tooth pulled. If you're getting a back tooth pulled, sometimes they'll say, you know, you have a cavity or you have a root canal, let's just pull that back tooth. Don't worry about getting an implant. For most people, I believe getting an implant is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Just depends on the type of implant, obviously.
100% depends on the type of implant. Don't go do a titanium implant. I'm not a fan. You have to go to a biological dentist, get a zirconium, get ceramic. We want to make sure that material you're putting in your oral mucosa is not going to leak and give you problems elsewhere in your body. We see that a lot. But I do think that the balance of the bite is extremely important. So when you're missing one tooth, that tooth has to have a partner. It has to meet its opposite tooth. And what we'll see is something called super eruption. And I'm not a dentist, but I've learned a lot about dentistry, where the opposite tooth will come down to meet that tooth, or it will come up depending on what side.
So in my case, my upper right molar is missing.
So your bottom tooth might be coming up to try and meet something.
I wonder if that's true.
Potentially.
Yeah, I feel it. This one is up a little bit up.
So, yeah. That will keep going and that will change your bite. So for me, like me telling you now, like I would recommend probably going see someone, getting an implant so those teeth meet, also to give you a little bit more balance in that cranium. Mm-hmm. Because when
you're missing it. I've noticed that, and I don't know if this is correlated or not. I've noticed that my right eye, the eyesight is way worse than my left. That could be a variety of things that are leading to that. But it is interesting. It's on the same side that I had a root canal, then had the tooth fracture, and then had it pulled.
Is the eyesight worse since you got the pulled?
I mean, it was when I was 16, but I just know that this eye is progressively worse than my left eye.
Yeah. So that there's a lot of reasons as to why that can be. We actually typically will see left eye slightly worse than right.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of
times.
Could
it be because I'm left-handed that it's opposite?
It could be different for you. Okay. It could be different for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I just will see astigmatism and sometimes less acuity in the left eye, meaning how well we see.
Yeah.
Should we go into vision? Should we talk about vision?
I have one more question on airway and teeth. This is just a larger meta question. How exactly does that tie back to what we were already talking about earlier with breathing and with our feet?
Yeah.
Obviously, airway restriction, you're not going to be getting as much oxygen intake, for lack of a better term, might be electricity intake, whatever. But aside from that, how might they relate as well?
Yeah. So your teeth, how your teeth hit, you have your teeth and then inside your tooth, you have a periodontal ligament, and that gives a sensory feedback loop to your brain. Mm-hmm. So when those teeth are not, let's say your bite is off. Let's say we have somebody with a cross bite, meaning it's very asymmetrical. One side of their mouth is kind of coming out. You can see their bottom jaw is maybe coming forward. Their teeth are not aligning properly. How it ties back to breath is because it ties to the position of the body. So we will see people in these patterns where they're pulled over on the right side, and people with a cross bite, they won't be able to get to the left. No matter how much I do for them, breathing wise, technique wise, we try all this stuff. A lot of times they'll be so stuck and so overly pulled here that they can't get back on, find center essentially. And sometimes I'll put a popsicle stick in someone's mouth and their whole body will loosen up. The same way when I give somebody different shoes. So this type of person who comes in with a bite that's off, what we do is I start with shoes, I give them techniques, we do a few sessions, and then they're still coming in and I'm feeling their neck and it's still locked up. And I'll say, okay, my techniques are not fighting your cross bite. I think we need to go to my dentist. So I will go with my patient to the dentist and we will make a mouth guard. Our mouth guards I work with some dentists that make, they use a nylon material, so it's not problematic for our health. And it's a flat plane splint. So a lot of things in dentistry are patented. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way of dentistry, where they, all these dentists like to make money on their tools. But most of those patented tools, in my opinion, don't do anything to make the body neutral. So what we get is a flat splint. So it's a, it's only for the bottom teeth, and it's flat, and it's ever so slightly molded to give the brain better sensory feedback of the teeth. So if they don't feel a few teeth or a side of their mouth, I'm giving them more feedback. The same way the arch on the foot gives them feedback from the ground, I'm now changing. I'm not doing it. The dentist is doing it. I'm just guiding. And I'm saying, hey, let's give this person a little bit more right canine, left molar, whatever I want in the bite. But there are certain checkpoints that I'm looking for. And we do it standing, because your teeth need to interact when you're standing and upright.
Interesting.
Yes.
So it has to be done standing.
I personally, yes. For me and how I work, yes.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense if it's tying back into posture and airway. If we're just assessing someone while they're laying down in a dental office, that's not going to be the full picture.
Yeah. Because the body changes upright.
Yeah.
And then you can add vision on top of it too. So usually from this dental piece, then, you know, we might need to tweak it. We might need to do one or two sessions adjusting the appliance. But a lot of times we see significant relief. And these are complicated patients. This is not the typical patient. I would say maybe 10 to 20% of my patients need a dental appliance. And I've worked with a bunch of different dentists to learn from them and also to be able to give the patient the best care.
Does this help at all with palate expansion, or is it just remediating at some level, not going into palate expansion?
It's not going to expand because it's just flat. But I will tell you, my own mouth like opening increased 4 millimeters from a dental appliance.
Really?
So what happened there was my body posture changed so significantly. My head moved back in space, and the joint, the TMJ joint, now has more ability to move. And so I was able to literally open my mouth more.
Wow.
Thicker steaks.
Okay. Cool.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we do see that quite often, like mouth opening or like lateral deviation, things like that. They'll be able to shift their jaw better.
Wow.
Just from a flat plane splint. It's just...
Are you wearing that at night or...
I only wear it at night, yeah.
Okay, okay.
And all my patients only wear it at night. And it's minimal. Some of my patients, I will have workout in it because their bodies will lock up. And then they're working out. They're still working out one side more dominantly than the other side.
Got it.
So then you give them the flat plane splint if that's their root cause, and then tell them to work out. And they'll be like, oh, I felt this this so much stronger than I typically feel it. Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It just makes you think in a really different way.
No, it totally
like
does,
I didn't learn any of this stuff in school. None of it. I never learned about teeth. I think we had an optometrist come and talk to us about eye injuries one day, but like physical eye injuries, not about vision, not about the visual system. You don't learn it in traditional medicine. Everything is so siloed.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Another question. Sorry. And then we can move on.
No,
to
it's
eyesight.
Fine. You're good.
What's your opinion of mouth taping, and then also the nose strips that you can wear that expand your nostrils?
Yeah, I'm a fan.
You are a fan.
Yeah, I love mouth taping. If you're capable and able to do it, I'm a big fan. I don't think that there's any great mouth tape on the market that's completely non-toxic and completely not uncomfortable. I really don't like that hostage tape, which is basically like K-tape. I don't like that. Company.
Why don't you like that one?
It's just so intense. I don't like full coverage mouth tape.
Okay.
I think it could be dangerous, especially for children. For children, they have, I think, like MyoTape is the name of it, where it goes like as a square around the mouth. And for adults, I just use like, you could literally use scotch tape and just a little strip or just like a little bit.
I have hostage tape, but it's because I have a beard.
Well, understandable.
It comes off either way.
I'm sure.
But, yeah.
There might be some workarounds though.
Yeah. I got to figure that out.
Yeah.
Okay, one more airway thing. I want to move on, but I'm listening.
No, it's fine. It's good information for people.
What is snoring typically indicative of?
So, right, traditional medicine will say it has to do with weight. I do think that that is a contributing factor. I don't think it's everything. I think it tells me a lot about the expansion of that person. And so expansion. Okay, so traditional medicine looks at it from a weight perspective. Myofunctional therapy and people, dentists that zone into the mouth, look at it from expansion. They don't have enough expansion. They don't have enough room in the airway.
Okay.
Then they'll do that on somebody and they'll still be snoring. Mm-hmm. So my perspective is those two matter, very important, but what is the position of the body? Because if the body mass is super forward and their whole center of mass is forward, their head is coming forward, now we have an airway that's limited due to positioning. Mm-hmm. So if we change that body positioning where you get them more back in their heels, able to move side to side, we get their base of their skull kind of coming back and give them back that curvature in the neck that we're meant to have. We're meant to have about 30 degrees of curvature. Then we'll see a decrease in snoring. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a lot about positioning. I do think weight and airway expansion have a role, but I don't think it's everything. I think it's three pieces of that puzzle.
Got it. After we go fully up the chain, I would like to talk about like general posture recommendations and things like that too, if we could.
Most healthcare today operates on an outdated mechanistic model, treating the body like a battlefield rather than a self-healing system. You wait months for an appointment only to receive a rushed diagnosis that labels you rather than truly understanding your unique health. Even in holistic health, many practitioners rely on endless lab tests and supplement protocols, addressing symptoms instead of the root cause. And the result? Another prescription or supplement regimen that merely suppresses or masks symptoms rather than facilitating true healing, whether the imbalance was physical, emotional, energetic, or a mix of all three. And that's why Dr. Tom Cowan co-founded the New Biology Clinic, to offer something radically different. As one of the most respected natural health doctors in the world, Dr. Cowan has spent decades challenging conventional medicine and advancing a deeper understanding of human biology, water, and natural health. His work isn't just about rejecting the mainstream. It's about offering a more truthful, biologically coherent approach for healing. The New Biology Clinic recognizes that health isn't about fighting disease, it's about restoring balance. You're not a diagnosis, you're an individual with a unique story, and healing should honor that. With virtual consultations available worldwide, the clinic offers a flat rate monthly membership that gives you direct access to practitioners who take the time to actually listen. Members also get exclusive health live streams, a resource library, and live sessions covering everything from biofield tuning and breathwork to movement and meditation, all designed to support whole body healing. And if you're not ready for a membership, you can book a one-time appointment, sign up for an enrichment-only membership for the healing modalities alone, or schedule a free connection session with one of the care team members to see how the New Biology Clinic can help in your specific situation. This isn't about keeping you dependent on doctors. It's about making you sovereign over your health. Head to newbiologyclinic.com and use code THEWAYFORWARD, and that's spelled the way, F-O-R-W-A-R-D, for $50 off account activation, or just head to the show notes for more info. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com for $150 off. Your body already knows how to heal, and New Biology Clinic helps you remember.
Okay, one more question. I'm sorry for those that are listening, watching, like, when is he going to move on to the eyesight? This one's not related to airway specifically, but since we're on the topic of sleep, because we're talking about mouth taping and nose taping, what are your thoughts on bed, if you have any at all, and then also sleeping position?
Like mattress?
Yeah, mattress type and then sleeping position.
I did like a deep dive a few years ago when I was buying myself a new mattress. So this is kind of like the shoe conversation. There's like nothing perfect. I bought myself an Avocado and I like it. I want a mattress with springs. Mm-hmm. That is ideal, to have as many springs as possible. In the non-toxic world, that's not how they typically make them.
Yeah.
So I found a hybrid mattress from Avocado that—
Why do you want springs though?
Springs are the same as like giving your body some feedback from the ground.
Okay. That makes
sense. So
that
spring is like, you're just getting, when you're laying there, it's something pushing back into you.
Yeah.
So that is important. I also think firm is really important. A lot of people really like firm. Some people hate it. When it's too squishy, you're not getting that feedback from the ground. You need that for your sensory system. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's also a comfort, right? Whatever people are most comfortable in is going to be important. I like the Avocado. I do think it's a little too squishy for me, to be honest. There's also the Sattva. There's some other brands that are non-toxic that do have springs. Mm-hmm. I did write an article about this. I think I'll put it on my Substack. I was thinking about that last week. So that might be.
We'll throw it in the show notes then.
Yeah. Because I was thinking about that because I do get that question a lot and I want to educate on it as much as I know about it, but springs are really important and non-toxic, no VOCs, no off-gassing. That's just, in my opinion. Yeah. And then sleep position. So I don't tell people how to sleep. That is, you know, they'll come to me, they'll be like, my chiropractor told me to sleep this way. I personally struggled with insomnia for years. And so the last thing I would have ever wanted somebody to tell me was how to sleep because all I cared about was falling asleep. Mm-hmm. And I know I see a lot of chronically ill patients that struggle with sleep. So I'm not going to put another thing kind of on their head.
Yeah, just sleep however you're comfortable.
Sleep however you're comfortable.
End up with you in pain, right?
One other thing people always ask me about is pillows. So this is unique about me. In 2021, I decided to stop using a pillow because I was traveling so much. It was actually more annoying to have to be like, oh, I don't like this pillow from this hotel. So I stopped using a pillow and I talked to one of my mentors about it and he was like, we're not meant to use pillows.
Makes a lot of sense. And I've thought about that, right?
Babies don't use pillows in their crib. And when did we use pillows in?
Isn't that just leading to more forward head posture if you sleep on your back? And then if you sleep on your stomach, then it's releasing to you. It leads to you having an more anterior extension. Pelvic tilt, right?
Yeah. And in our ancestors, they didn't sleep on a pillow. You know, I'm not going to tell everybody just if you sleep on three pillows, you're not going to just go to sleeping on nothing. You have to slowly wean yourself down. I started with like folding up a blanket and then just eventually taking that away. And I never really have any neck complaints. I feel really good, especially since I made that change. But people cannot believe it when I tell them that. They're like, you don't have pillows? This is like friends will come over. They'll be like, where are your pillows? I'm like, in my treatment room.
You don't have any throw pillows for decoration?
I do, but like on my bed, there's no pillows, right?
Right.
So it just looks like a bed with...
Yeah.
So people always joke about it. But yeah.
You might as well go like full Japanese style at this point and just get a bed that's like low to the ground or just sleep on the ground.
Or like on the ground.
I have friends who do that who swear by it that they only sleep on the ground.
Yeah. I feel like sleeping actually on the ground or like on something really small on the ground, that is how we're meant to sleep.
Yeah.
So.
I think so too. And it made more sense back then too. We were sleeping on dirt floors likely, which means we're literally sleeping on the earth. Connected to the earth.
Oh, frequency, right? They have these frequency things that you could put under your bed.
And the problem that I've learned with a lot of the grounding sheets and just grounding mats is not all, but some of them that I've explored, you're inviting dirty electricity and you're not actually sleeping on something that is only grounded in that it's touching the ground. It likely has components of dirty electricity given all the wiring as well.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, which that part sucks. I have seen some people take a small copper wire, feed it through their window onto their bed.
Yeah, so, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, finally, let's talk about eyesight now. I'm going to just let you
go about eyesight. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about like some basics. A lot of people wear glasses. Sure.
Yeah.
When you go to an optometrist, they typically check your prescription. So what are they looking for? They're looking for your acuity, which is known as your sight. Vision is different than sight. Being able to see that says, you know, words right there, that is my ability to have sight, proper acuity. Vision is how well your eyes work together. Not every optometrist or ophthalmologist for sure is checking vision. I work with behavioral optometrists because they check vision. They look at sight too. We want to make sure you're driving and you could see the signs, but they're also looking at how well your eyes work together, your depth perception, your ability to track the multiple things they're looking at. So that's number one component. Cause a lot of people will be like, I see just fine. I'm good. And I'm like, no, there's a lot more questions I need to ask to know how well your visual system works. So when we're thinking about vision and we're thinking about optometry, typically you go into your ophthalmologist or optometrist office. Optometrist is a little different than ophthalmologist. Ophthalmologists are, they've gone to medical school and a lot of times they could do eye surgeries, et cetera. They're specialized. Optometrists also specialize, but most of the time they're a little bit better at looking at vision compared to, they just are trained a little differently.
Got it. Okay.
Behavioral optometrists are what I work with. So you go into your ophthalmologist's office, they sit you down in the chair, they bring the fluoropter up to your face, and you kind of put your head right into it. It blocks off all your peripheral vision because it's so big. And You're looking at, you know, the poster and they're saying, what's better, one or two? You're sitting down and they shut the lights off. So all of these things influence your sensory perspective of what's happening. So when they are getting your prescription, they're getting an inaccurate prescription based off your environment.
Your inside forward head posture.
There you go.
Cutting off your peripheral vision.
Sitting. Where do you use your eyes? You use them standing outside with lights on, moving through space, playing baseball, playing basketball.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what the standard is, why they've done that. But what happens is when they're correcting you like that, you become very focal versus peripheral.
Got it.
We, for vision, we need periphery. Mm. We need to think about somebody who plays tennis. I recently picked up tennis a few years ago. I need to see in my periphery where my partner is, make sure I'm not going to run into her. Same with basketball, for sure. Very peripheral.
Yeah.
So there are some sports that are very focal. Gymnastics, I was a gymnast, is quite a focal sport.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly pinpoint staring at the end of the beam, things like that.
Yeah.
So when it comes to that prescription, just basics, getting that prescription done, most of the time, most people that come in, I'd say about 70 to 80% of my patients are overcorrected. So that's just number one. I was overcorrected for years. It really impacted my sleep.
Didn't you reverse your eyesight issues?
Yeah. So I do have a prescription. I just don't really wear anything. I should wear something when I drive at night. But yeah, I did. I was negative almost 1.75 in one eye and 1.5 in the other eye.
Wow.
Negative. And so my left eye has always been a bit worse. My story is interesting because I actually had a head injury at age 12 and age 15, I got glasses. So that is very, I see that a lot with people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in glasses from age 15 to 30. So about a couple of years ago, I stopped wearing glasses and now I don't wear anything. I do have some visual things though that I can see okay enough to get through the day. My mm-hmm. left eye is worse. My right eye kind of takes over.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have some other visual issues. So I have reversed my sight problems, a lot of them. My right eye is actually plus 0.5 now. So it went the other direction. It reversed so much, it went the other direction.
Wow.
And that is just due to positioning and then some dental stuff when I did that dental appliance. Wow. We see that a lot with people. So in general, a lot of people are wearing the wrong prescription. They're walking around in that. It's tensioning their whole body up. So they're wearing that a lot of times, a distance prescription, they're wearing it on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to tone your body up. So making sure you go get a proper refraction. A refraction is when you sit down and you do the exam. That is something that from a low-hanging fruit is really important.
How many eye doctors actually offer something like that, though?
I tell people to go to behavioral optometrists. Okay. Yeah.
So specifically a behavioral optometrist.
Yeah, so behavioral optometrists, there's a couple different organizations, NORA, COVD. I actually lectured at the COVD symposium earlier this year, and wow. They loved it because they get it. Mm-hmm. They understand. They understand that vision is so important, and they want to make some significant changes. Those are the people that are looking at kids with eye turns. If you ever like see somebody and their eye slightly is a lazy eye.
Yep.
There's reasons for that. There's a lot of reasons from a neurological perspective for that. So they use different types of lenses to change the picture so the eyes look a little bit more straight. So there's a lot that can be done there. And when you combine it with what's going on in dentistry, we can make really significant changes for the patient.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm a generalist, but I've had to learn so much about optometry. You can't just walk into an optometrist's office and be like, hey, I want to work with you. They're going to be like, what do you know? At this point I've learned so much from them, but we can make some really, sometimes we're just taking down a prescription. Sometimes it's too high. We just take it down. That's easy. Usually I send my patient to go do that themselves. Sometimes we're playing with prism. Sometimes we're playing with the astigmatism correction. So there's a lot of different things that you can do with a lens the same way you could do with a mouth guard, the same way you can do with arches on the ground to help change the person's sensory experience. But the visual system is much more specific. It's 80% of our sensory world comes from our eyes. So what we do to our eyes can make a really big difference. Mm-hmm. I worked with a baseball player once that they changed the prescription like plus 0.25, which is literally nothing. And his throw went up 5 miles an hour.
Wow.
So these small, especially in that level, you're going to see big changes. But these small tweaks can make somebody's chronic pain decrease significantly.
The other recommendations that we've talked about throughout this episode, do you oftentimes see people, this almost seems rhetorical, I'd imagine the answer is yes, their eyesight improved just by adjusting those things as well?
Yeah, a lot of times even just lowering their prescription, a couple months later, they'll need to lower it again because mm-hmm. then their eyes are actually working the amount that they should be working.
Yeah, I'm so, talking about like the shoe
record. Shoes, yeah, for all sure. I tell my patients to come into the eye exams and the dental deliveries wearing a good shoe because I'm not going to do the appointment with them without a good shoe on just because it changes their system. Sometimes we do a technique before we do the delivery. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we do techniques while the eye exam is occurring. Sometimes I make them wear their dental appliance during the eye exam. So there's a lot of things, but yeah, I see changes, significant changes.
What are your thoughts on contacts?
I think contacts give you a little bit more periphery in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think, okay, from...
How toxic are they, though? Like, has anyone really looked at that?
Most of them are really probably pretty toxic. I wore them for like 15 years.
The only time I've worn them lately, first off, I want to say when I started wearing them, I noticed my eyesight get exponentially worse once I started wearing them.
So is it the contact or is it the prescription?
Right, exactly. But I specifically asked for a lower prescription because I've said this. I still haven't done it to every time I've gone to the eye doctor. I'm going to reverse my eyesight naturally. I know it can be done. Like I've seen it happen via a variety of ways. Someone that I know did an extended water fast and went back 3 prescriptions. Someone else just did a bunch of eye exercises. There's also this lady who I'm supposed to interview sometime in 2026 who has what's called the clear sight method. So there's multiple approaches to it. But I specifically asked for one that wasn't as, you know, like overcorrected. And even then my eyesight got drastically worse, but I only wear it if I am speaking on stage and I know that I'm not going to have my computer in front of me. I'm going to have to look at a confidence monitor or something like that.
Yeah.
That's like the only time. Other than that, I refuse to wear them. But there's also problems with most contacts nowadays have blue light blocking technology and UV blocking technology.
Yeah. So they're, and glasses do too. So you can get,
Windows do.
Yeah, I know.
Freaking windows in our houses
it's
do
insane.
Nowadays.
We're
it's
like,
insane.
We don't get the full spectrum of light. No. You can get incandescent bulbs now, sort of.
Sort of. Yeah.
But, so there are total daily one contacts do not block, the majority of that light spectrum.
Cool.
They're a little bit more of an expensive contact. It's actually funny because I was so allergic to most contacts I tried that was the only brand I could get. So growing up, I wore contacts, but I wore total daily ones. So it's interesting. And then mainly because they were clearly toxic if I was having an allergic response to them. Mm-hmm. Like I would have, my eyes would get super itchy and they would pop out. So I couldn't wear like AccuView. There's glasses also block UV light, but you can get something called the CR39 lens, and it's a cheaper lens than polycarbonate. Polycarbonate's not great, and that's what most glasses are made of, polycarbonate lenses. And so CR39 are cheaper, and that doesn't block UV light. So there are options out there, but I will tell you, for years, and sometimes I see this, sometimes actually, if you go to a really good optometrist, the lens prescription that they'll give you will help you reverse it.
Mm.
So I wore something like about a year ago and it definitely helped me change. It changed. It actually changed more about how my feet and ankles felt on the ground.
Really?
Yes. Because your eyes and your ankles are like, and feet are directly linked.
Interesting.
Because how are you going to know where to walk if your eyes don't sense it from your environment first?
That makes a lot of sense.
So when I hear
that's interesting because my right foot turns out and my right eye is bad.
Maybe, could be related. When anytime I hear ankle rolling, we were just talking about your ankle injury, I'm automatically thinking, what are the eyes doing? If I hear chronic ankle rolls, that tells me something.
Yeah.
It's pretty, certain questions are really good to ask for, and I'll tell your audience. I ask my patients, like, did you struggle with school growing up? How was it for you to learn how to read? Do you like reading today? If those questions are like, yes, I struggled with school, I hate reading, I've never liked reading, that's already a red flag to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because a child actually likes reading. They're supposed to like reading unless their eyes don't work well together and it's so hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
If reading comprehension is super difficult for a child, that's because their eyes are probably not working well together.
Interesting.
Other things, car sickness is huge. I actually got kind of car sick in my Uber ride the other day. So I was like, oh no, I need to go get my eyes looked at. But I know the signs, right? So car sickness is a really big one. So kids that just get super car sick, to me, something's going on with their visual system.
Interesting.
Some other questions I ask. Yeah, super forgetful with things sometimes, because if they're really focal and not peripheral, they'll be really forgetful. Of course, that might have to do with other factors like ADHD. ADHD and convergence insufficiency has a really big link, which
what's
means
convergence insufficiency?
Yeah, being able to converge your eyes is being able to bring
got
them
it.
Together. So if a child is struggling with doing that,
yep.
we'll see ADHD.
Like if one eye doesn't track as well
or
as the other one.
Or they both just don't come in as well. Ah, could
it.
Be that too, though.
Yeah.
There's lots of reasons. So those are like important questions.
Yeah.
I always ask about school, all my patients. I always ask about car sickness just to figure out a little bit more about them. Head injuries, any sort of anyone who's had a concussion, their visual system has been altered a little bit.
I think a lot of people don't know what a concussion actually is, though,
yeah.
because most people think concussions is like when you black out after you've been hit in the head, or you just like,
yeah.
like complete almost black out. But it's really like almost any head trauma,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
I've had so many concussions.
Then. Yeah, no.
so many.
I understand. Any sort of head trauma, I'll ask people stitches, car accidents, or whiplash, anything like that. Because if you hit your head, like a lot of young boys hit their head on corners of things in their
yeah.
houses, this is like a common thing
I've
learned. And they'll get stitches and they'll just be like, oh, well, I was 2.5 years old. And to me, it's like, well, that's actually significant because your visual system's not developed fully.
Wow.
So it tells me something going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And whiplash, even if you're hitting, like if you fall snowboarding, you're falling on mm-hmm. your butt, that ricochets up the chain. And any sort of loss of consciousness injury, like you said, blacked out, that to me is another category, but that's an extreme category. But all these things are head injuries and your mm-hmm. body keeps the score. Your body remembers all of this.
Right. So you're not against glasses, right?
No.
Okay.
I'm against glasses that are done incorrectly, the same way I'm against braces that are not done at the right timing. I think glasses can be a huge tool for certain people, and a lot of people actually need glasses for their healing. I send people to my optometrists all the time knowing that they're going to prescribe glasses. I think that there are certain times where we'll prescribe a glasses and it'll be like, okay, let's check back in 5 or 6 months, and then we tweak it and change it, and that's the idea. I'm against somebody just going, getting their eyes tested in a conventional standard way
Got
for
it.
20 years on end and never looking at their visual system. And you know, another thing with eyes, LASIK.
I was just about to ask you that.
Go with your question.
Go ahead. Please tell me why it's so bad.
LASIK is so bad. LASIK is so problematic from multiple standpoints. Not only is the surgery problematic, and I'm not even going to get into so much of the health concerns with the surgery, but there are people that are committing suicide because of LASIK eye surgery. And this is more common than people might think.
Really?
Yes, because if you have a binocular vision dysfunction, any sort of eye issue, any sort of tracking issue or eyes not working, teaming together issue, they're not testing that before you go get LASIK. You're not going to a behavioral optometrist before you go get LASIK. So this issue might go underlying as a really significant issue. You could have struggled with school. You could have had all these red flags and it just wasn't picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you had a concussion that gave you some sort of palsy in a cranial nerve, and maybe now your eyes aren't perfect. And then they'll say, okay, you see just fine. You can read the letters. Let's do LASIK eye surgery because you're annoyed with wearing contacts every day or wearing glasses every day. And they do LASIK. And then these people are waking up with extreme problems, dizziness, vertigo, double vision. Their surroundings are different. You're altering your most important sense, your visual system. So from a perspective of that, that's problematic. I will also see patients struggle. I just had a patient a few weeks ago. He's like, it took me 2 years to get comfortable with my new LASIK prescription. I was like, that's not normal.
Right.
Nothing about that is normal. You shouldn't feel like that. A lot of times LASIK is overprescribed, so they do the wrong prescription because they're going off of the same body posture position and they're not looking at it outside. They're just, you know, they do,
out of context.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not a proper prescription.
Yeah.
And then from a body perspective, from a postural perspective, it all goes back to that internal asymmetry. If your body's pulled over here, and then we'll usually see cranium torque in a different position. Now we're correcting one eye differently than the other versus getting the body what we call neutral and then re-examining. So when I send people to the optometrist, the goal is to make sure the body is neutral when we're giving them the new prescription. So they're getting more accurate prescription. So LASIK is super problematic. It's a real problem.
I think another element with LASIK too is because it's changing the cornea fundamentally. It's changing the way the eye processes light, yes, which is ultimately disrupting our circadian rhythm.
Yeah, cataracts does too, because cataracts are replacing your lens.
Yeah.
And there is a type of cataract lens you can get that doesn't disrupt the UV, but that's not what they're typically recommending.
Right.
And I did a deep dive on cataracts like a year ago when my mom had to have it done, and we got it squared away. But same thing, something else with vision is when people get older, they start to have presbyopia symptoms, meaning they don't see well up close, they don't see so well far away. So let's just give them a prescription that's a progressive. Mm-hmm. So they'll do a multifocal, they'll do a progressive. Your brain is literally not meant for that. Your brain is meant to see in the distance and to accommodate to see up close and then to go back to the distance. If you give somebody multiple prescriptions in one lens, that is very confusing for the brain.
Yeah. To switch back and forth to that degree.
Yeah. Or even in a pair of glasses.
Yeah.
These people, I see them in Manhattan going, walking outside. They're wearing a progressive. So now they have the ground coming up towards them and they have to extend their entire body posture,
yeah,
to remain upright. And not to mention how much neck movement happens when you're wearing a progressive. And a more old school approach is something called monovision, mm-hmm, which is literally, when I hear anybody come into the clinic that tells me they have monovision, I'm like, okay, well, we're starting there, because it is the worst thing that I see in the clinic. It is when that is happening, presbyopia is occurring, and they decide, it's a very old school approach, they decide to correct one eye to see up close and one eye to see far away.
Wow.
And they'll choose an eye to be your dominant eye.
That is insane.
I know, but it still happens.
What?
It's much more common with like older humans, but I've seen it.
That's wild.
And it's really hard. And sometimes they do that with LASIK. So now they're gluing that onto your eye.
Wait, what? They, yep, do monovision with LASIK?
Yeah. They push the, that's multifocal, so for LASIK all the time. They were trying to get somebody I know to get multifocal LASIK of cataracts. And I was like, why would you do that? You've never even worn a progressive glasses.
That's insane.
And that's more expensive, the multifocals. So, mm-hmm, of course they want to push that, but
of course,
you know, yeah, I made sure, but yeah, monovision is pretty crazy. I have a Substack article written on that too, because that's just, people need the education. It's just, mm-hmm, hidden information. So yeah.
All right. Is that sufficient for vision?
I think so.
Okay. I want to talk about facial symmetry. We touched on a little bit, and then talk about just the more, now that we have like a fuller picture of all the things that go into posture and body mechanics, some postural corrections that can be made to get to a neutral position, given all that context.
Sure. So facial symmetry is going to go along with body symmetry. Usually we'll see people that have really asymmetrical faces. They also have really asymmetrical bodies. So it's the same thing. I'm looking at the sensory system. I'm looking at the respiratory system. I'm working with both to integrate that into the nervous system to make changes. And like I said earlier, posture and asymmetry is really one of the later things to change, but we make changes. We make changes faster than if you're going to a regular PT with pain, who does a traditional approach. This alternative method is going to make changes, but we have to integrate with the sensory system. And we will see a lot of, everyone's a little different. There's different things we see. When I see a left eye that's slightly higher than the right eye, I know that person's most likely had some head injuries due to just my education. I can look at some people and I can see certain things. Mm-hmm. When I see one ear flared compared to the right, I know what's going on with the temporal bones.
Wow.
We see jaw deviation that also can contribute with what's going on with the temporal bones. If the jaw is going to the right versus the left, it means something different.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different cranial patterns that can be changed. It just depends on what you're doing to change it. And unfortunately, not many providers know what to do. So you can...
Does a lot of it go back to airway stuff?
It goes back to airway. It goes back to head injuries. It goes back to the rest of the body, how the body manages space. Could go back to vision, could go back to dentistry. So it depends on that person. So
like you see, for example, if someone has their like left pelvis is shifted and their right pelvis is more back.
Yeah.
And let's say they like lean more to their right, they might have some corrections that their body has made where their left eye might be a little bit higher than the right or something like that.
Yeah, I'll see the left eye higher with head injuries, to be honest.
Okay.
Like if they've had significant amount of head injuries mm-hmm. or trauma, emotional trauma.
Mm.
I'll see that a lot. The eye position is reflecting the sphenoid bone. It's a butterfly-shaped bone that's sitting behind your eyes that okay. house your eyes. So typically we'll see the right eye higher, but when I see the left eye higher, I know that there's like something more going on. But it really honestly depends on someone's history and their story for mm-hmm. me, because they might have a typical normal asymmetrical body, and then I'll see this torque in the cranium. And I know more is going on. And also those people that have more torque in the cranium, they typically have more pain.
Got it.
That like they've tried everything and it doesn't work. So there's different types of asymmetries we'll see in the face. A lot of this information also comes from craniosacral therapy, mm-hmm. which can be wildly beneficial for helping with these asymmetries, especially if you don't have a provider like me around you.
Mm-hmm.
But
how many people are providers like you who are trained on this? And it's called PI.
Yeah. Postural restoration.
Okay.
PRI.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does I stand for? Institute?
Institute. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
About 200 of us in the country.
Okay.
So not that many.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that are learning it, but to get to the higher level of doing the vision and the dental, it takes a while to feel confident enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the asymmetry can change. It's just as we untwist things. I would still, even if I saw all this with somebody, I'd still start with like, get the person in a good shoe.
The feet first.
Yeah, that's why it's such a low-hanging fruit for anybody listening. That's the first thing
mm-hmm.
you want to do. That's what I would recommend.
Got it.
Yeah.
On the symmetry thing, you know, it's really fascinating to me is I've seen some of these videos that have come out on social media that are talking about how beauty actually is patterning, meaning that there is a pattern in human facial structure that reflects beauty that people tend to find more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with symmetry.
Yeah.
And it's typically people who have more of an expanded palate, a jaw that is not recessed,
mm-hmm.
and symmetry in their face as well.
Yeah, that is for sure the typical. And attractiveness also, we're more attracted to somebody who looks a little bit more symmetrical, has a, especially, men who have more of a jawline, that mm-hmm. is important. Women too. I have a post coming out about the chin. Like there's a video where all these actors and actresses, and you just shave off their chin and how different they look.
Yeah.
But that has to do with airway, has to do with the jaw and jaw development. And it really does. You can look at, I can look at people and I could tell you about their lifestyle without them telling me anything by just looking at their face.
Wow.
Which is really interesting. And it's cool that I've gotten to that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, the attractiveness and beauty standards, it has to do with symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
It does.
It's wild.
Yeah.
It's crazy how there does like seem to be a pattern. I mean, it's the same way when you look at buildings, like when you look at buildings that are built like the Capitol buildings across the United States, they invoke a sense of beauty in most people who look at them. It's like inspiring to look at. It's the same as it applies to human beings. It makes a lot of sense. Okay. Now that we've kind of put all that together as it relates to posture, I want to talk about some just other general corrections in terms of our gait, in terms of how we sit, in terms of how we stand, as it relates to our posture to get to a more neutral position.
Yeah. So when it comes to sitting, that's like one I tell people about and correct, especially from an ergonomic standpoint, from working, work desk setup, you always would want, first of all, you want to be in a good shoe, especially if you're working from home, just wear a good shoe, right? So then I tell people, elevate your feet a little bit so that your knees are higher than your hips. Just offloads the hips a little bit. It takes the tension off and allows your pelvis to posteriorly rotate on both sides so you can feel your sit bones. Those sit bones give you a little more access to your hamstrings, puts the rest of your body in a good position.
Yeah. So like even right now I'm in, what's opposite of anterior pelvic tilt? It's
posterior.
I'm very posterior. So now I'd be on my sit bones.
Yeah.
Right?
So that's good. So that's good where you're at. You're also tall. And so your knees are naturally higher than your hips here, which is, and you can actually put your feet on the ground. So that's another thing. Like I'm short. My feet don't touch the ground in a lot of places. You want those feet to touch the ground. Even in baby high chairs, when they're eating, a lot of the times they don't have a platform for their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wild to me because you want to digest well. You want your feet on the ground.
Interesting.
So actually, sometimes I'll eat standing, especially when I'm at home, because it's better for my digestive system.
Oh, wow.
To have your feet on the ground. So some tidbits there. So yeah, just elevating your feet. When I work at home, I have a little platform. I lift my feet up. So that's something. And feeling your sit bones, that's a really easy key for somebody. And because we know we're really shifted over to the right side, what you can do is shift your body weight slightly over to the left. So just feel your left one more than your right. And that's something that you can bring awareness to.
Is that why you were sitting like that for this podcast?
No, this was actually just position.
Okay, because you were shifted more to your left.
I actually do think I'm a little more comfortable here.
Okay.
I don't know. Okay. This worked out really well for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I am a little more comfortable. I'm not in the best shoe for what we're talking about, but...
time and a place, though.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how it works. So it's 80-20, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like one of the biggest tips I'll tell people. For standing, you want to always just unlock your knees a little bit. A lot of women I see, especially like pregnant women, that their body weight is forward, the knees are like constantly locked out. And that's just putting a lot of stress and strain on the ligaments. So just to have some slight bend in your knee will allow you to feel your heels on the ground, which again gives you feedback to your hamstrings, which helps to pull your pelvis under. So that's like a very easy fix. If you're standing in line at the grocery store, you just unlock your knees, feel your heels on the ground. And those are like pretty solid, low-hanging fruit to just get people started so that people can feel some of the pressure changes in their body. Mm-hmm. And then like we mentioned before, even just doing that exhale that we talked about, that will make a significant difference for a lot of people and how they feel internally, plus a good shoe. Like that's
so just focusing on exhale more than the inhale, yeah. Essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't correct people's gait. Like I don't tell people to change anything. If I were to say anything, I would say swing your arms.
Okay.
That's the biggest thing. Make sure you swing your arms. Do not have your head looking down at your cell phone. Most people will carry their phones in the right hand, stare down at their phone. Swing your arms. Don't hold anything in your hands. That's what I would do. You know, a lot of women wear purses, switch sides, don't only use it on one side, try to always wear it on the other side too, even if it's uncomfortable. So lot of times when we wear that purse, it'll be on the right side, most people. And then that right arm doesn't swing, which a lot of times is already limited. There's a whole reason why, but you just want your arms swinging on both sides because it helps to move your thorax.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my tips.
Got it. Another thing that I see happen with people who tend to have rolled shoulders and forward head posture is they'll try to do these like self corrections, drawing their shoulders back, and even do some corrections against the wall where they'll like tuck their chin in to, you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm really against all of that because it's just forcing you into more of an extended position. So every time you bring your shoulders back and together, your rib cage, your forward, anterior rib cage pushes out. And so we're extending even further. And that's the same cycle of being an extension. So what a lot of our breathing techniques do is they put you in what's called systemic flexion. You're rounded and you're breathing into your back and into your chest and teaching you how to breathe in a very different position. The chin tuck thing too, I find very problematic because if you have a forward head posture and you're just chin tucking, you're not going to make significant change down the chain at all. And you're actually just cutting off your airway. Mm. So we do a lot of breathing techniques with a towel roll underneath the neck to bring the head back in space. And that's really where we're going to see some change is getting the ribs down and elongating these neck muscles, getting the obliques on. We can make some change, getting airflow moving in different positions.
Yeah, it's such a flip on what I thought before, right? Because I've always thought, okay, if we're sitting in this position a lot, right, then what we want to do is correct on our own by doing this. Yeah.
No, I know. I was a gymnast, so I did that majority of my developing years. So I, even though if you test my body, what we call hold neutrality, I will still look like that because I did that during developing years, which is fine. But that to me is not good posture. Good posture is having your ears over your shoulders, over your hips, over your ankles, and having that, I hate the word alignment, but it is alignment.
Right.
Having that position where you're stacked. And also good posture is being able to come onto your right side when you stand on your right leg, and then being able to come to center and being able to come to the left side. Our body has to organize itself over each side, meaning pelvis has to do one thing on the right side while opposite is happening on the left side. Rib cage has to do one thing on the right, opposite on the left. Same with the neck. So We have to organize our body on the right, come to center, organize on the left. That to me is posture. Mm-hmm. It's not, okay, if I see shoulders rounding, then I know that person's in so much extension that their brain is like, well, we can't breathe. So let's just bring our shoulders forward.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they're in too much extension.
Yeah. What? They use those people that are really, really rounded cannot breathe.
Wow.
And their heads come forward to find air.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are your opinions on stretching?
Yeah.
And mobility training?
Coming from me being a gymnast, mm-hmm. I've always prefaced that because I stretch for the majority of my life. I'm not a fan of stretching. I never stretch.
Even
now.
Dynamic stretching?
Like dynamic stretching is okay. Right? That's fine.
Okay. Is it more just to like create blood flow and heat and movement?
Yeah, that today when I worked out. I think that that's totally fine to move through movements. Static stretching is a problem because now we have a body that's patterned and we're stretching our ligaments to an extreme. My hardest patients are yogis and contortionists by far.
Really?
They not only have chronic pain, they usually have autoimmune. They usually have so much going on with their hormones. They have a lot going on because their bodies have absolutely no stability. They have no groundedness.
So they're hypermobile, hyperflexible.
Beyond. Hypermobile patients are difficult. You have to give them groundedness. And sometimes these patients, you give them groundedness and their brain freaks out, doesn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, yeah, that's such a flip too. Because like, what about the people who've done yoga for years and years and feel great? Do you think that they're like counterbalancing it with other activities?
They might be. I would say they're not doing traditional yoga in the U.S. They're probably in other countries doing a different type of yoga.
Got it.
From what I've...
You're talking about like the white LA chicks who go to a yoga class.
Yeah.
Got it.
That yoga is not ideal.
Got it.
I think the other types of yoga are a bit different. Mm-hmm. And I, from what I've done, I actually enjoy yoga. I think it's great. I think some of the movements, there is a nice balance of strength. I just think you need to have control over your system. I can control my system. I'm not worried about overstretching myself. Mm-hmm. Whereas most other humans today, they're overstretching. Mm-hmm. Their position is a mess in those classes.
What about like hip mobility training and things like this?
Same thing. So there's a lot of stuff with those 90-90 positions. Have you ever seen that?
Like, are you familiar with pails and rails?
Yeah. I'm actually FRC certified. No.
Damn it.
Do you do it?
Why? Yes, I still do.
But you've been doing it for a long time.
No, I've only been doing it. Well, I've done it a lot throughout my athletic career, but then more recently I've been doing it consistently.
I don't have a problem with the isometric component.
Okay.
I think that's fine. I think the rails is a little too extreme, to be honest, because what is going on with the positioning in the first place? If you're doing, for your audience, pails and rails are like this type of contraction and then release, but you're still contracting. I took it so long ago, I don't even remember the details, but it's this type of training method to help you get more range of motion, essentially. But if you have a pelvis that is on one side forward and one side back, your femurs in that pelvis are not articulating the same on both sides. Mm-hmm. So we might see a limitation in internal range of motion on one side, limitation in external range on the other side. But if you just stretch your way there, the reason is the pelvis.
Got it.
The reason's not the femur. So then it's actually just pulling on all those ligaments. I did it for a while too, when I wore my barefoot shoes.
When you wear your barefoot shoes, I'm wearing barefoot shoes doing pails and reels right now.
We're going to fix it. We're going to fix it.
Maybe just briefly your thoughts on exercise and just movement.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially now, a lot of people are very into primal movements or workout programs and schools of thought that are different, like functional patterns and things like this.
I'm going to give one of my close friends a shout out because she has this app called the LOA app, L-O-A. And I personally love it. If I wanted to have gone into strength and to do strength and conditioning with what I've studied, I would have, you know, done what she's doing. And I'm so glad that she took it on because it's very difficult to understand these patterns and then to train in a way that is great for longevity. And that's what she's done. So she has this longevity app where she's doing all these exercises, but with the association of understanding your pattern.
Got it.
And that's great. I think that you could do whatever you want from an exercise realm, but I do think the things that are better than others, like, I mean, I was an Olympic weightlifter. I did overhead press a lot and I did clean and jerks and all that stuff.
What are your opinions on snatches?
I loved snatching, to be honest. I loved it. It was so much
fun.
For
the common person, though.
I think it's horrible for a common
person. When I go to a CrossFit gym, right? I haven't in a long time, but when I used to go to a CrossFit gym and there's one level one CrossFit instructor instructing 30 people on how to do a snatch.
Yeah.
That's so problematic.
It is such an intricate movement. Yeah. It is not a functional movement. Snatch, clean and jerk, deadlift. Maybe deadlift is closer. Squat is a little, front squat and squat is a little closer to a functional movement. And bench press, not functional movements.
Yeah.
Not in my opinion. I loved snatching because for me, I did it for joy and for athleticism. It is so intricate. I worked hours on perfecting my snatch and clean and jerk. And I do not think regular people should do it at all. I don't think people that do CrossFit for a few years should be snatching. I think that we are putting the body under so much stress. I think, I mean, we talked about it for a little bit, women's hormones. I don't think they can handle that amount of stress.
Yeah.
I know from working with people from my own experience, and I do not think that that's the type of training that we need for longevity at all. I do think we need to lift weights. I don't think we need to lift as intensely or as heavy as people are pushing. I think lifting weights is very important because I think that's what our ancestors did. I think that,
in different ways. They weren't actually like in a gym lifting weights. They were just moving heavy
like boulders,
objects.
Yep. Right. So I think that that's a really important thing to think about. But I think from everything we talked about in this episode, just understanding that there's an asymmetrical influence on the body. If you understand bits and pieces of that, you can train according to that. So even rows, right? I will do a row, but I have my rib cage flexed and I am in a state of a rounded state of flexion so that I can do, and then I do it alternating.
Mm.
And I do it alternating because then I'm getting one movement on one side of my body and another on the other. So
do you do a lot more dumbbell than you do barbell at this point? Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes a lot more sense.
I haven't like lifted, snatched or clean and jerked in like years.
Wow.
I feel like I'd still be able to do it though.
I feel like that's what led to my shoulder injury, honestly.
Probably.
Because like, I can think back to a CrossFit workout I was doing where I experienced a pop in my shoulder, and I had experienced them before, but not to this degree, doing snatches specifically, doing heavy snatches. I don't remember if it was during the strength portion. No, it was during either an AMRAP. I don't remember it, but it was during the actual workout portion, during the WOD. And so,
I mean, it's a significant movement on the entire system, but especially on the shoulder.
Yeah.
You're coming from here and then it's very, very significant.
Not functional at all, but it is a sports specific movement in that if you are an athlete who is an Olympic lifting athlete, that is a movement for that sport.
Yeah. I love athletics. I love sports, but sports are not health.
Yeah.
At all.
Mm-hmm.
So just something to take into account.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to cover?
Oh, this was amazing.
Yeah, this was great. I feel
so
like we
fun.
Covered a lot of stuff. So
yeah.
It was good. Please plug any of the stuff you're working on, any of the stuff you have as offerings.
Sure.
We'll throw it in the show notes.
Yeah, sure. I have a breathing basics course. It's very simple. It just gives people their starting basic techniques. And that's where I tell everybody to start. I also have a course on dentistry and a course on optometry that gives you a lot more in depth of what we just talked about. But I always tell people to start with the breathing basics. To find me, it's just Alina Kanner. So you can check it out. Check out my website. All my stuff is Alina Kanner. Make it simple.
Super simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.